Tonight on The Down Low, rock musician Ted Leo, comedian and Simpsons writer Dana Gould, and another installment of the Swap Meet with Greg Flamm. Now, here's your host, a man who is looking to go as clean-shaven Arietta for Halloween, Justin Kaufman.
So just go as a guy that nobody recognizes and is freaked out when you say, hi, I'm Jake Arrieta. No, you're not.
How's everybody doing? It's a download here at 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman with you till 11 o'clock tonight here. Beautiful Michigan Avenue studio, a little crisp, a little brisk. Talking about frost advisory. Inland frost advisory. So, Iowa? I don't know about you, man, but it's nice. I guess I look at it this way. I like it when it's here. I don't like it when it's coming here, if that makes sense. So, like, yesterday, I was like, what's happening? It's so cold. Last night, I just, blanket, not cold, yeah. But once you're in it and you've adjusted, you're like, oh, fall, Chicago. Oh, nice. So it's crisp. It's like a honey crisp apple. That's what I would suggest for the weather word today. We got a great show lined up. I'm so excited about tonight. The hits keep coming. Ted Leo is here. Ted Leo, the longtime indie rocker, who Ted Leo and the Pharmacists, been playing for 15, 20 years now. I mean, one of the best names in indie rock, and he has gone solo, left the Pharmacists behind, although he still plays with them, and put out a new record, which many are saying is the best of his career. Talk with him about writing music, about living that indie rock life. Ted Leo, my guest tonight at the big table. That's coming up at 8 o'clock. But first, Mike Fouché will be here. He's actually in Springfield, so we'll get him on the line. Talk about the veto session. The big stuff so far is that the right to work zones did not pass. There was no override of that veto. It fell one vote short. But also, which was amazing, and this is a big political thumbing of the nose to Governor Rauner, but the transparency bill that came out from Comptroller Susana Mendoza, which essentially the idea was to say that you need to be transparent with what bills you're holding on to and you're not telling us about. The governor seems to have this fascination in some of the agencies to be like, you don't need to know about that bill, the Obi-Wan Kenobi. That's not of your concern. And the comptroller wants them to release that. And the governor vetoed that bill. And today in the House, 115-0 was the override. Democrats and Republicans coming together to say enough's enough to Governor Rauner when it comes to his handling of finances in his agency. So that's a big, that could say something. We'll talk to Mike Fouché about that. Coming up in the 9 o'clock hour, Dana Gould will be here, longtime stand-up podcaster and, of course, writer and producer on The Simpsons and Stand Against Evil on IFC. Also, Allison Cuddy's back. She's the executive director of the Chicago Humanities Festival, which this year, the Fall Fest is beginning, and it's all about belief. That's the theme of this year's festival that brings a lot of stars and academics and others to Chicago to have conversation around the concept of belief. So we'll talk with her. And of course, the swap meet coming up with Greg Flamm, where we evaluate your memorabilia, your collectibles, your junk. 312-981-7200. That's the phone number tonight. News, weather, and traffic with Rob Martier and Esmeralda Leon. Production provided by my man, Pete Zimmerman. I'm Justin Kaufman, and this is The Download, a show about Chicago starring those who know it well. All right, we'll take a break, and we'll get to the carryout, so stay with us. All right, so Download here, 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Let's kick this show off the right way with the carryout. All right, here are today's top stories. Governor Rauner debuted a new television ad called Thanks, Mike, which features big-time stars like Wisconsin Governor Scott Walker, Indiana Governor Eric Holcomb, and Missouri Governor Eric Greitens, all saying thank you to Mike Madigan for increasing taxes and stopping Rauner's turnaround agenda because it's been good for their states. Man, I will say, the charisma alone in that ad. Governor Holcomb, breakout star. Greitens, oh my God, how is he not in the new Baywatch? I mean, so hot. So much makeup. And Scott Walker. I mean, the way he says, our economy's on fire. I mean, it makes you wonder how this dude does not have his own sitcom. But seriously, does Rauner have no civic pride? Those guys, regardless of party, are not the guys you want on your side. We're Illinoisans, right? Just having those governors on our TV sets is a surefire way to lose the populist vote. Scott Walker, the governor of the Packers? That's who's on your side? What's next? Aaron Rodgers going to tell us how bad Illinois roads are? No thanks. Not a good move, Governor Rauner. Lots going on in Springfield today. The House was unable to override the right to work veto. This bill would have prohibited anyone working a union job to skip union dues. But Rauner's veto holds, so now that can happen, or they go back to the drawing board or whatever is going to happen. Which I got to say, this issue is kind of bogus to me. And I know, nobody asked me, so but I'm going to say it anyway. If you work a union job and you get the benefits of union negotiation for better pay or better health care, shouldn't you have to pay dues for that service? Right? I mean, it seems like that's a no-brainer. Otherwise, negotiate with the company on your own. See how that works out. I'm not trying to get political. I'm just thinking of fairness. It just makes sense that if you're going to get the benefits of a union job and union pay and scale and everything that the union representatives do to get you more money to negotiate with the corporation, that you should pay in for that. I find that to be somewhat, I don't know, it just seems no-brainer, right? Just being real. Kaufman being real here. The U.S. House is set to vote on the Senate budget tomorrow, and by doing so, we'll be able to unlock the famed, quote, reconciliation, which somehow bends the rules to let bills pass in the Senate with simple majorities instead of the traditional 60 votes. Is that where we're at now? Is that it? Nice to see that the nuclear option's being used on every single thing that Congress takes up. This will make it easier for Congress to pass tax reform, which right now still includes a provision that would end write-offs for state and local property taxes. What? This would disproportionately affect those who live in higher taxed areas like New York City, LA, and right here in Chicago. Some even go as far to call it an attack on, quote, blue states. New Jersey Democrat Congressman Bill Pascrell said, how can you justify keeping the deduction for corporations but taking it away for American families? You know, I've never heard of this Pascrell fellow, but I got to say, I like the cut of his jib, right? I mean, come on. I mean, is that for real? Are corporations still allowed to deduct property taxes, but the individual will not be? Republicans are already saying that they will announce a compromise on this issue early next week, so maybe that's what it is. But Pascrell, where you been all my life? Way to break it down, make it real. This is a real carryout. Pascrell, move to Illinois. I know nothing about this guy. The NAACP put out a travel advisory warning African Americans from flying on American Airlines. They say there have been several incidents, and they suggest a corporate culture of racial insensitivity and possible racial bias. Ouch. I mean, the airline is called American, so what do you expect? If it's true, good on the NAACP for speaking up. But now, maybe the NAACP can help us figure out why it costs $700 to go to L.A. during spring break, right? Normal flight, $300, but $700 because they can. I'm just saying, NAACP, you could be heroes for everybody, not just black people, everybody. Think about it. You can expand. I'm not kidding. I looked it up today. $700, all airlines, because it's spring break. The week before and the week after, $300. But $700 because they know that people are looking to fly to get out of Chicago in the winter. Where's a Trump tweet when you need one? Even Southwest Airlines. A2 Southwest? Come on, man. Unreal. In weather? Man, I had to turn the heat on last night. Nobody ever wants to turn on the heat. Obviously the cost, but it's that moment where we all go, man, I really hope the furnace kicks in here. And I really hope that my house doesn't blow up. So far, so good. We'll see. In sports, the Hawks became the latest team to get beat by the Golden Knights in Las Vegas, who are now 7-1. What? The Hawks, on the other hand, started great, but now trail the Blues by a point in the Central. But it's early, and it's the Blues, so I wouldn't worry about it, but still. The Bulls lost their third game in a row. They dropped to 0-3 to start the season. They looked to be playing the Cavs tough last night, then it slipped away. Another great, at least first half, but another great performance for the rookie Lauri Markkanen. He's getting high marks, but the Bulls continue to limit his minutes. because it's the Bulls. I'm not sure what's happening there. Justin Holiday, Robin Lopez, and Lauri Markkanen are the Bulls' big three. Lopez, Markkanen, Holiday. Get ready for the new Adidas commercial. The Bears are back at Halas Hall for the good old Wednesday practice, and I heard a rumor that the Steelers are looking to trade wideout Martavis Bryant, and boom, in my feed, the Bears traded for a wideout named Dontrell Inman for a seventh rounder to the Chargers, so not Martavis Bryant. So far this season, Inman has lit it up. 2 catches for 9 yards, which automatically makes him the number one guy in Chicago. It's kind of ridiculous. They're getting after the Saints on Sunday. The Saints. Who even plays on this team? Yeah, I mean, we all know Drew Brees, right? But can you name another player? I mean, is Ironhead Hayward still carrying the rock? What about a Hobie Brenner? Is Hobie Brenner still playing tight end? On the defensive side, you got Jumpy Gethers. How about a Pat Swilling, the outside linebacker? A poor man's Lawrence Taylor. Or what about Louis Lips? Louis Lips playing wideout, still catching balls for the Saints? Yeah. All right. That's 80s Saints football. The Dodgers are up 1-0 after winning game one in less than 2.5 hours. Man, if I were a Dodger fan and I paid big bucks for that, I'd be like, come on! At least come out and do like 2 double switches so I can get another hot dog or a helmet sundae. It's ridiculous. ESPN tweeted out yesterday that if the Dodgers can sweep the Astros, they'll be the first team in modern era to lose less than 2 games en route to a World Series win. Just edging out the 1998 Yankees. Last I checked, the Chicago White Sox went 11-1 in 2005. So what up, ESPN stats? They've since deleted the tweet. But once again, the White Sox get no love from the national media. It's kind of ridiculous. Last year, they were omitted when the network was talking about past championships for Chicago when the Cubs won it. Now this, every year, they just find a way to omit the White Sox. I mean, the Colorado Rockies get more love than the White Sox. The Colorado Rockies. Gross. And finally tonight, a new cafe is coming to Wicker Park, which is great. That's right. The home of places like Urbis Orbis and Earwax. Now, a new cafe right in the wake. It's called Capital One Cafe. I'm just glad that Wicker Park is staying close to its roots and not putting another bank on the corner. Wait a second. Capital One Cafe. It's a bank, isn't it? It is. Well, if you can't beat them, I guess you join them. But listen, I mean, now I can get a mean chai latte and an even meaner home equity loan. I mean, I think it was Bob Dylan who once said, the times, they are a-changing. But to be clear, this bank is not going to accept change. That's the carryout for October 25th, 2017. Hey, we too have a cafe and a bank here at the carryout. You get a coffee and we'll give you financial planning. First piece of advice, you're paying too much for coffee. Just stop. Do it at home. All right, coming up, Mike Fouché is going to give us the latest from Springfield. He's down there. He joins us as he does every Wednesday. And coming up at 8 o'clock tonight, famed indie rocker Ted Leo. Lots to do tonight, so let's get to it. It's a download, 720 WGN. Stay with us. Six3O says, airline prices are driven by supply and demand. Are you against this business concept? I say yes. I mean, I don't buy that. I mean, it's anticipatory. There's no way. I mean, because you go to any week at an airline site and they say, only 4 tickets left on this plane, then why isn't the price $1,200?
I frequent airline websites just because they always try to find a deal because they see something. Oh, yeah, on Twitter. Ooh, United Airlines, fly here. We got great fares to blah, blah, blah. Sale ends in 2 days. Right. And then it's like just to St. Louis.
Right.
You know, well, the whole thing. Trick you.
It's October. And we're talking about March. And so I can understand the concept of supply and demand when there's one seat left and you want to go somewhere with a week to go. But the concept that we're 6 months out and you're acting like everybody in Chicago is trying to go to Los Angeles. No, that's anticipatory. Rob Martier, talk me off the ledge.
I think it's probably a matrix that they've put together, the airlines.
Yeah,
and
absolutely.
Their numbers suggest that in March there are going to be X number of people wanting to travel to Los Angeles.
Right. Absolutely. I agree with you.
So
100% that they know in advance that there's going to be a demand on it. So they jack the price before they even people see if there's any demand on it.
Yeah.
It almost feels anti-capitalism to do that. It's one thing, supply and demand, I understand that concept, but to be anticipatory, it messes with that formula.
I do agree with you, but here's the thing. If you don't like the price, you don't have to go.
Yeah, exactly.
So.
And you know who loses out? The La Brea Tar Pits.
That's right. The Dino Museum.
The Kaufman family is not going to the La Brea Tar Pits. So when they're complaining to the state of California saying, oh, we need extra money because nobody's coming out, blame the airlines.
The Dells are beautiful in March.
The Dells are beautiful in March. Yeah. When does Ishmael open, right? All right. Here's the news sponsored by Lindeman Chimney Company. I need to take a deep breath before Mike comes on.
Group hug.
Here's Rob Martyr. Thank you, Rob Martyr. Download here, 720 WGN. Justin Kaufman with you till 11 o'clock. Coming up here, we talk with Ted Leo, the iconic indie rocker from Ted Leo and the Pharmacist, my guest at the big table. Excited about that. But first, let's talk Springfield veto session underway. Some fireworks today, some victories and some losses, I guess should be some nail biters and some landslides. Mike Fouché from the Daily Line joins us as he does every Wednesday. Tonight, he is in Springfield for the veto session. We'll talk Springfield and also what's happening with the Cook County budget. Mike, good to have you.
Ooh, Springfield. Yeah.
there you go.
I'm here. It's the best.
All right, so let's get right to it. We've been reporting on it all afternoon, but there seems, it is nail biters and landslides. First, let's talk with the nail biter. The Democrats put together a bill that essentially would make it illegal for right-to-work zones where people could have union jobs but not play union membership. The governor vetoed it. There was thought that they could get that the override done, and they came one vote short of doing so. Talk about this. Is this a victory for Governor Rauner, or is this a way to reset and start all over?
It's really none of those, truthfully. I think the measure could have actually gotten the votes to pass, except that it had a really interesting aspect to it, which was that if a municipality were to create a right-to-work zone, then the officials of that municipality would be charged with a misdemeanor. They would essentially be criminalized.
Wow.
And so that really, really upset a lot of Republicans who really didn't like the idea that, as one member said, that you'd be criminalizing municipal officials for doing their job. So that really held them up from that crucial 71. They stopped at 70 votes. They couldn't get it all together. But truthfully, this really doesn't mean all that much for Rauner, because he had tried. He had this idea of enterprise zones, right-to-work areas, and only one municipality actually did it. I think it was Hoffman Estates, and then it was struck down by a court. So nobody's done this. Nobody's going to be doing it. It was, in a lot of ways, a demonstration
symbolic,
of power. Yeah, it was very symbolic. Rauner, put a lot of energy into it, mostly because he really, really seems to dislike the unions and doesn't think that unions are good for business or for government.
And there is a Supreme Court case that deals with this exact thing that will be decided at some point in this session that looks at the idea of union membership or someone having a union job without having to pay dues. This is an issue, an ideological issue that
right.
has been on the table, not just in Illinois, but it will be represented by an Illinois constituent.
And that actually, I think, applies to government worker unions. And yes, it would. It seems very likely that the U.S. Supreme Court would decide in favor of not forcing workers to have to pay worker or union dues unless right. they choose to. And that would be incredibly debilitating. We've been writing and investigating that, and a lot of unions in Illinois are very, very concerned about that. Firefighters, police officers, regular worker, government worker unions. I think that would be a big deal.
Hmm. The other issue, which was the landslide, is Susana Mendoza's Debt Transparency Act. This is interesting because this was something that essentially the comptroller said, hey, listen, we're not – We need to, the public needs to know about all the bills that we have in backlog. There are so many. And the governor and the state, I guess, in some cases, and different agencies are like, well, you don't need to see that bill, or I don't need to show right. you this or that or the other. And they put together this Debt Transparency Act, and the governor vetoed the act, and it went back right. to the House, and what seems to be somewhat of a shock, a unanimous override.
Yeah. Yeah, it was. You know, essentially, this is a power struggle between Bruce Rauner and Susana Mendoza, who is a Democrat, and Rauner, of course, is a Republican. Rauner liked the idea of being able to squirrel away, you know, bills in various parts of government and then be able to spring them up. And you know, by squirreling away various bills, he can essentially make Mendoza pay for one thing or another by being strategic about it. This way, you know, the Debt Transparency Act basically makes every single agency have to report regularly exactly what all of their bills are that they've incurred so that Mendoza can know what it is that has to be paid. The comptroller's responsibility is making sure that the bills are paid. And so they have to judge what the cash flow is and figure out what has to go out.
And also, Mike, I mean, the big thing as well is it also paints a more realistic picture of where we are yeah. as a state when it comes to our debt.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And there's always been, you know, a question, well, do we owe another $1 billion more? I mean, you know, maybe, you know, it's always impossible to know. Mendoza produces these regular reports and, you know, without actually knowing that specific amount of money, it's been difficult to know how deep a hole Illinois is actually in. So what's interesting is that this originally passed the House, I think, with 60 something votes the first time around. And now this time, it passed 115-0, which means that every single person that was present voted for it. And that was remarkable. I don't think anybody expected it to be that high of a number. There was a lot of expectations that it was going to pass, but with that big of a number. And really, the only way that that happens is if large numbers of Republicans decide, you know what, forget the governor. And we don't really have a whole lot of confidence in the way that he's necessarily managing government. Hmm. And I think that's actually the case with a lot of Republicans.
Wow.
They're not confident that the governor is managing government well. And this is a statement, you know, to tell him, sorry, man, you know, you still have to do things that we tell you to do because we're the legislature. And, you know, there's a lot of tension there because Bruce Rauner really, really rules the roost when it comes to the Republican Party. Almost all of the fundraising goes through Bruce Rauner one way or another. So, you know, all the Republican legislators are very much captured by Bruce Rauner.
And the other political part to this is, when is this going to affect? Because we're entering or already into an election season. And if the bills are released and they have to be with this Transparency Act, and it shows that the state of Illinois is in more debt and the governor was covering it up, that's not a good campaign. That's not good for yeah. the campaign for reelection.
It's going to be effective immediately. It still needs to pass the Senate. But, you know, the Senate, which is not going to be meeting for another 2 weeks, but it's very likely, highly likely that the Senate is going to pass and vote on it. So, you know, I don't think this is going to be a real issue.
Let's take a quick break. Mike Fouché, The Daily Line, joins us every Wednesday. He is in Springfield. Let's do this. I want to ask you, I got a couple more questions about Springfield, but I want to get to the break, and then we'll talk. We'll finish up with the Cook County budget as they start to work at revenue now that the sweetened beverage tax is no longer. Mike Fouché joins us. We'll take a quick break. Stay with us. Mike Fouché on the line. Here in 720 WGN, he's in Springfield. We're talking about the veto session and what's happening with the Cook County budget tonight. Mike, of course, with the Daily Line, thedailyline.net. He joins us every Wednesday. All right, Mike, I'm interested, before we move to Cook County budget, yesterday out of committee, essentially a gun law came out, which was reported on, the idea that at first it looked like it was going to be Illinois' attempt to ban bump stocks after the Las Vegas shooting, but it goes further than that. There's capacity or in magazine capacities. There's assault weaponry. The Illinois State Rifle Association came out and said, no, this is way too broad. But the Democrats are going ahead with it. Where is that at? Because there was thought that the House might vote on that, and it seems like it's something, since there is a Democrat majority, that could find its way to Governor Rauner's desk.
So there were a number of technical issues with the bill, and I actually caught up with Representative Marty Moylan, who's from Des Plaines, a Democrat from Des Plaines, at the end of the day, and I asked him, you know, where's this going? What are we going to hear about this anytime soon? And what he told me this evening was that he's waiting on the updated language in order to fix the bill. And as soon as he has that, he's going to bring it to the floor and, you know, introduce a floor amendment and try and pass it in the House. The House is meeting tomorrow at 10:30. And the expectation is the House doesn't really want to meet for very long because a lot of members want to go back home. So I would expect that we'll be seeing it sometime tomorrow before lunch.
Mm, interesting to watch.
And the House will probably vote on it.
And if they vote on it, it gets passed, it gets to the Senate, and goes to Rauner. And like I said, we were talking about it yesterday. I mean, that's a hot potato for the governor. So it'll be interesting to see what he does, especially in light of what he did with abortion, things of that nature.
It's going to be a couple weeks before the Senate addresses it because the Senate is not meeting tomorrow.
Right.
Right. They took off. That's exactly right.
Well, they did. I mean, come on. Well, we got nothing to do, so we'll, all right. That's my pet peeve, the idea that they do that all the time. We'll move on. Cook County budget. This is very interesting. 10% cuts across the board. That's what Commissioner John Daly had said to deal with the fact that sweetened beverage tax is coming off the books. Sheriff Dart, the state's attorney, Kim Fox, others saying, nah, I can't comply. Where are we with that? Because you guys did a great breakdown in all the different agencies and areas that have already complied, but there are some holdouts, and Sheriff Dart seems to be the big one.
Sheriff Dart is the big one. You know, the jail population has reduced a lot. It used to be an average of about 10,000. Now it's down to about 7,500. And so there's a lot of questions coming from the Cook County Board. Well, how come your budget has essentially stayed the same? How come your budget hasn't gone down over the last 5 years like your jail population has? And one thing a lot of people don't know is that the jail has been under a federal consent decree, much like the one that we're talking about with the Chicago Police Department, because of the way that it was managed. And the consent decree was only very recently begun to be lifted because they've had so much progress in the management of the jail. Dart argues, look, if we start cutting the number of staff that we have, the number of officers that are working in the jail, that means that we're going to really start risking having another consent decree, and that's just going to end up costing us a lot of money again anyway. And then the other thing that he says is, well, the reason why we have so fewer people in the jail is a lot of those people are now being monitored at home with ankle bracelets and that sort of thing. And so we need to have officers whose job it is to monitor those people.
Right, right.
It's less expensive than having them in the jail, but we still need to have people whose job it is to make sure that they don't, you know, run away to Iowa or
That. Well, I mean, what are the big ideas? I mean, we're talking about closing some suburban courthouses. There's talk about the Cook
That's
County
the
Forest
big
Preserve
idea.
Officials. Like, what are the big ideas to get this budget in check?
You know, one big idea is to cut the Forest Preserve District Police, which, you know, is not very large. Maybe that'll give you some savings. But, you know, the bigger dollar amount, you know, that'll give you tens of millions of dollars a year is to cut one of the suburban courthouses, like the one in Skokie or the one in Markham or the one in Maywood. There's three of them. And, you know, everybody's, oh, that's great. Found money. We can close one. And then it gets down to, all right, which one are we going to close? And then that becomes a whole nother kettle of fish.
Yeah.
And the other thing is that nobody's really asked Chief Judge Tim Evans what he thinks about that. And there's a pretty high likelihood that Judge Evans will not like that idea, because if you close one of these courthouses, that means that workload needs to go somewhere else.
Right.
And so it's not like the cases are going to disappear. It's not like these people are sitting around doing nothing.
It's going to be a headache,
So, you know, that's going to be a pretty significant change.
Mike Fouché, he, of course, runs the dailyline.net and joins us every Wednesday here on the Download to talk Springfield, Cook County, and Chicago politics. We didn't even get to the Chicago stuff. We'll do that next week. Mike, great to talk to you. Travel back safe.
Thanks a lot.
Welcome back to Download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Well, my next guest is a singer-songwriter who just came through Chicago for the Goose Island Block Party. Chicago, put your hands together for Ted Leo.
Everyone in Chicago, put your hands together.
Unless you're driving, right?
not shattered on this stretch of sea. How many times I stood here mapping things out differently, but I can't go back.
Can't go back, can't go back.
No, I can't go back.
Can't go back,
can't go back. Cross the road and run back to the town. How many times I've run this way and how it runs me down.
That's the track Can't Go Back from Ted Leo's new solo album, The Hanged Man, the album that many are calling the best of his career. It's the first album he put out in a couple of years, not counting the Both, the album he did with collaborator Amy Mann. Ted Leo and the Pharmacists have been an indie punk staple for years. It's hard to believe it's been over 15 years since the 2001 album, The Tyranny of Distance. Ted Leo currently lives out in Rhode Island, but he spent some time in his life right here in the area in South Bend, Indiana. Going to Notre Dame. One of the best songwriters working today. My pleasure to welcome Ted Leo to the Big Table. Good to see you.
Thank you so much. I'm really glad to be here.
I say it's the first in a while. I mean, really, since 2010. You do the Both with Amy Mann, and that was in between there. But talk about, like, you've got a lot of great reviews on this record, but talk about the time off and getting back in the saddle.
It is interesting because I was only able to look back when I got to the end of this time and sort of finished the album and realized that, oh, I've actually done a lot of work in the last almost decade, because it felt like I was spinning my wheels for so long because I wasn't actually putting anything new out there, you know. But I was touring a lot. I was playing solo a lot. I did the whole record and touring cycle with Amy as the Both. You know, but I just was living a life for a while and trying to figure out how to even conceive of what a next record for me was going to look like.
Yeah.
I had you know, I was in a bit of a stagnant place with my label, and I had a lot of personal stuff go down that, you know, really just required being
to be
around.
There. Right,
yeah,
right,
you know,
right.
And if again, like it felt in the midst of it like I wasn't doing as much. But then I looked back and I had this huge body of work.
Yeah, I wonder if it's expectations too, because you and Ted Leo and the Pharmacists put out records every 2 or 3 years. It's an expectation we're going to get new music front facing, meaning we're going to see it beyond just the touring and things like that.
Yeah, certainly. And, you know, I have to keep putting stuff out so that I can keep touring if I want to keep making music professionally, because that's the only way that, you know, to earn a living doing it. So there was also that fear, like, you know, every time I would get to the end of a month and look at my bank account, you know, I'd be like, whoa, I really have to get a record out, you know.
Yeah. You mentioned a lot of different interviews that this record came from a personal place, The Hanged Man. You talk about at one point personal desolation, you know. Talk about that. Talk about writing from a place that's personal.
Yeah, I mean, I always have to a certain degree, though I have, you know, rarely have I had a number of years that hit me with as much, you know, to potentially write about as the last few. But I'll tell you, I don't think I really ever set out specifically to, you know, set myself a task like I need to write about this or I should, you know, I think I would probably be a bad person if I saw, oh, yeah, that's some good writing material there.
You'd be a comedy writer.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. But, you know, these things find their way out. And then eventually what I did have to come to terms with was not I should write about this, but am I going to allow myself to write about this stuff?
Right.
And then how am I going to
How do you do that as an artist? That's such a heavy thing to think about, you know, the topics that you're going to approach in your art, in your song, and in the music that you produce. how do you convince yourself? Where's the line to say, yes, I'm going to write about this. I'm going to put this on the album. I'm going to open myself up.
I think the task is just making it a good song, honestly. You know, if it's a good song, it's a good song. And I hope that I made some good songs out of it. You know, you just do what you do with every other song, which is sit down, figure out what you want to say with each piece, find the best way to say it. If you don't want to be quite as direct about something, you find another way to say it, you know?
You know, I think about the old adage of the novelist. You know, you live your life before you write your novel. Go out and experience as much as you can, you know, be in a position so when you sit down, you have experiences to draw from. As a singer-songwriter, especially one that's had such a tremendous, prolific career as yourself, do you take on that kind of philosophy when things are happening? Like, live my life, you know, the good stuff that happens, the bad stuff that happens, and at a later time, I can reflect and put this into my art.
I don't know, to be honest with you. Maybe I do, maybe I don't. I think I never really approach any of this, either life or art making, you know, with a specific agenda. Mm-hmm. That's not to say that I don't have, you know, long-term goals or anything, but I kind of try to take things as they come, and when it's time to do something, I try to do it. You know?
What's great about The Hangman, the new album, is it's very diverse in the music that you put out, meaning not just the song, the lyrics, things of that nature, but the music. You go from fast tempo, which you've been known for, to much more diverse, slow stuff, changing up the rhythm. Was that intentional for you to essentially do something that you, Ted Leo, has never done before?
I will say that there was some intention in that, yeah. I think that once I really understood that the process of this record was going to be largely me alone, building my studio and making the record at the same time and really mad scientisting, you know, everything, I think I did make a little bit of a conscious decision to not stifle certain impulses that, you know, like some of the weirder, slower stuff on the record is always with me and has always been in my head. Yeah. But, you know, I would often not let it come out as such. You know, I'd have to beat it up a little bit into, you know, some other kind of form. And I think I did make a conscious decision to just let it come out the way it came out. And at the end of the process, I had around 30 songs, only 14 of which made it to this very long double record. So I have this whole other batch of songs that I have to do something with still. And in looking at it, you know, I'm some of it is very much in line with, you know, what you might expect from a Ted Leo and the Pharmacist record, hopefully with a little bit of songwriting evolution in one direction or the other. And some of it is new and weird and spooky at times even, you know.
Yeah.
And what I had to stop myself from doing was forcing the only slow and weird and spooky record on people.
Because you find yourself going there? Like that's what you were gravitating to?
Yeah, because, you know, that was new and exciting for me. And I, you know, I was like, I just want to shove that out there and make people deal with that, you know? But at the end of the day, I think I did find a way to have a nice dynamic, you know, up and down over the course of the
year. Well, it's considered to be one of the best of your career. Everyone giving great reviews to the new Ted Leo record, The Hanged Man, which is out now. Okay, let's do this. Let's take a quick break. We'll come back. And I'd love to talk to you more about the process because, you know, just the idea of you building a studio in your home and being isolated like that to create music, there's a lot of questions I have about that experience. Okay. Ted Leo's my guest tonight on The Download at the Big Table. Stay with us.
As I was walking through a life one morning, the sun was out, the air was warm, but oh, 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 I was cold. And though I must have looked a half a person, could tell the tale in my own version, it was oh, oh, only then that I felt whole.
Welcome back to Download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. My guest in studio at the Big Table, Ted Leo, longtime singer-songwriter, Ted Leo and the Pharmacist. He's got a new album, The Hanged Man. You've played Chicago many a time. Mm-hmm. Talk about your experience with Chicago. I mean, what are some of the memories that come back for you?
So I started going to see shows here in the late 80s, and I remember seeing bands at the Cubby Bear and Dreamers. places in the metro, obviously. And, you know, I think my experience playing here has been pretty similar to my experience playing other places in that for a number of years, you know, we toured so much that we really did kind of build our audience in the old, you know, the old 80s hardcore circuit way of just like get, you know, the get in the van, we jammy Kano thing where you just go, right. You go back and you go back and you meet people and you meet more people. And so, you know, our shows gradually grew from smaller clubs to the bigger clubs and then a little bit back to some smaller clubs. You know? Yeah, but I've also, the person who books me has been in Chicago for years. So we always, you know, spend a couple of days off so we can.
I was going to say, do you try to do that? Do you try to, when you go to cities that you know, Chicago, even West Coast, do you find yourself trying to build in extra days to actually take in the city?
You know, rarely to take in the city, more to, you know, see people you have to see and do other things you have to do. But because you're doing that, it does afford you a little more time to actually take in the city.
Yeah. Well, let's get back to your music. I am fascinated with the idea that you built your studio in your house. And you recorded and produced and put this record together, The Hanged Man, all by yourself. And I don't mean like, oh, my God, congrats, Ted, you can do it all by yourself. But just there's so much that goes into that, especially when it comes to the creative emotions that go around being an isolated artist. We know that from painting. You know, people will be alone with their stuff. Writing is that way. But music is almost always collaborative.
Mm-hmm.
For you as a songwriter, take us through your process of collaborating with yourself.
Right. Well, it's hard for me to extricate the production aspect from the writing aspect, honestly, because doing it the way I did it informed a lot of the writing. You know, once I really felt that I had my sounds together the way that I wanted them to be, it actually opened up even more doors for me to expand what I was able to write.
Which is unique, because a lot of times it'll be demos done, the lyrics are first, and the production's afterwards.
Right. It is kind of funny. There are a couple of songs where once I figured out how to record to tempos, like to set tempos, you know, which was a new thing for me, you know, I was demoing to tempos. And there are a couple of songs where there are some artifacts that made it to the final version, like from early demos, like a little guitar solo here, a little guitar solo there. I would be listening, I was like,
huh.
Well, I don't need to change that. It sounds good and it's in tempo. Yeah, so, you know.
The beauty of producing your own stuff.
Yeah,
right?
Exactly. Right. But, I mean, you know, I'd be lying if I said I didn't enjoy it. I enjoy tinkering in that way. Not so much mechanically, but sonically, yeah. You know. And I really did have fun doing it. And my normal pharmacist drummer, Chris Wilson, played drums on most of the songs on the record. And it was a real sense of accomplishment to be able to invite someone into this like hermetically sealed, you know, world that I'd created for myself when I felt like I finally knew what I was doing well enough to track
it. What do you do to get past the moments when you're stuck? When you're all by yourself, you're solo. Artists have that moment, and that's why a lot of people work with other people to kind of get through that.
It can go one of two ways. Sometimes I will be able to say to myself, you know, you've done this before. You can do this again and, you know, get out the rhyming dictionary and a notepad and, you know, just actually work, you know, in that way that you were talking about novelists earlier, like in that way that novelists are sometimes like, I get up and I make my coffee and I write for, you know, 3 hours a day and it doesn't matter if I don't use it. Like, that's my writing time. And blah.
Right.
Sometimes I can force myself to work that way. And sometimes that works. Sometimes it doesn't. And sometimes I can't force myself to work that way and I just have to walk away for a while.
Yeah. So much is made about how much you're evolving as a singer-songwriter with the personal things in your life, but there's also the musicianship, and we'll also talk about the production. But how do you think you've evolved as a multi-instrumentalist? Because whether it's guitar, bass, other stringed instruments, whatever it might be, you're doing all of it. Right. So how do you evolve and make yourself a better player with those instruments?
I actually think that the recording and producing aspect of it, like while writing and while working on this stuff, helped me become a better player with a lot of it. Because I was working alone and on my own time and in my own time, I could just keep working on things. You know, I could keep trying to nail that thing that I wasn't quite feeling right, you know, I think I actually improved my chops on a lot of instruments by doing it. You know, the danger is getting too obsessive about stuff. But I feel like I was never super afraid of that. I've seen enough examples of other people doing that, and I think I have enough perspective and self-awareness to, you know, have been able to walk the right side of that line. But I do think that just the volume of work and the volume of playing just since I started the process of this record has made me a better player, a better singer. And I would also throw my years working with Amy Mann and her band into that pot as well.
That experience being the experience before you started this record, how did that help you? What did you learn from Amy Mann and other seasoned musicians who've been around?
I learned a lot. I mean, I went into working with her with very little knowledge of musical theory, and I literally learned some actual musical theory from her and her band. I think that what I've come to understand about how working with Amy specifically has helped me is that I think that we drew out strengths in each other that were maybe a little dormant, you know, and I think she actually taught me more about what I can do with my own voice and things than I would have pushed myself to learn on my own.
That's interesting too, because that's that collaborative nature. When we talk about the production, last thing we talk about on the music side, just the producing the record, doing it yourself, whether it be recording or producing or putting the mix together. How have you learned about that? Talk about that experience.
Going back to what we were saying earlier about, you know, a good song is a good song. I stand by that, and it doesn't have to, you know, be a Steely Dan, you know, perfect recorded record for it to be fantastic. Some of the greatest things, you know, that I've ever heard in my life are recorded on a boombox. You know,
and I would say some of the things that you've recorded yourself, early Ted Leo and the Pharmacist. Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, what I really wanted to do sonically with this was put it in the realm of recordings that I do most enjoy listening to, or that have sort of, you know, most influenced me. And I was joking with somebody about it being somewhere between Discharge and Steely Dan, you know, and that is
a good place to be.
And I feel like I kind of achieved that, you know, like I really worked on drum sounds, and I did so much research on specific mics and miking techniques. And over the years, I would gather one, you know, special 60s mic on eBay that I wanted here, and one 70s one there, you know, and I was able to cobble together a little collection of things that really did start to work for me. And then also, again, the academic stuff about learning about frequencies. What is less 8K going to do for this snare sound? You know, like, there's a lot.
Do you think, you know, you think about your career, is this all new material to you, or new information to you? I mean, because you've been around music your entire life. But the idea of going after working with Amy Mann, are you a whole different appreciation of music?
Probably, yeah. I've always had my hands pretty deep in the, you know, making of a record. I've never just handed it off to someone and let them run with it. But on the technical side of things, I also never really, you know, learned how to do it myself. I would ask people to help me achieve my ideas, you know. And I have, I think, evolved into being able to just achieve my ideas.
Ted Leo's my guest, longtime singer-songwriter. Ted Leo and the Pharmacist, of course, one of the best indie punk rock bands, punk, indie rock and indie punk, right in there somewhere, to come out in years. Of course, been playing since the 80s. Ted Leo, my guest tonight, talking about the new album, The Hanged Man. We'll take a quick break, get the update on tonight's news, and we'll continue our conversation. Ted Leo at the big table, stay with us.
Contract's a joke, but when you see smoke, you run toward the fire because you must. They all called your name when the crash finally came and left you to pick up the dust. I saw you walking in silence down to the bridge, but nothing went over the side. So I guess to someone with your heritage, withdrawal like consent is implied. And it's true.
Welcome back to The Download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. My guest in studio tonight, singer-songwriter Ted Leo. Ted Leo and the Pharmacist, a longtime great indie punk, indie rock staple. Ted Leo's got a solo album, The Hanged Man, which is out now. You talked a little bit about the personal stuff. One of the things was your relationship with the industry. You talk about the music, your label, you fall out with the label. This is more independent in the sense that you're producing it yourself. How did that experience, kind of going through the meat grinder with the music industry, how does that affect you now? How has that changed Ted Leo?
Well, you know, it drove me to think more seriously about crowdfunding, which has changed my life crazily drastically in ways both artistic and otherwise, because, you know, I'm not anti-record label. I mean, I wouldn't be where I am without the help of all the great labels that I've worked with over the years, including Chicago's own Touch and Go.
Yeah.
And I would not have been able to do as successful a crowdfunding thing as I did, you know, had I not built an audience with the help of all these amazing people and all these amazing labels. But, man, it has really shown me that all of that work, you know, it wasn't for nothing. In the past few years, I did feel a little bit out in the wilderness, you know. Some of that was my confidence being shaken by a lack of support from a lot of different quarters, but including my label, you know. But the way people poured out for the Kickstarter that I ran was just gobsmacking. Like, I remember, you know, I was nervous about whether it was going to fund at all, let alone in one day. And by 4 p.m. on the day that it funded, I was walking across the floor to the bathroom, and I was like, hey, wait a minute, this is going to fund today. And I had this weight that I didn't even know I'd been carrying for who knows how long, and I just felt it, like, dissipate. And then I was able to just kick into high gear, and I could finish the album the way I wanted.
It was motivating. It was inspiring, so motivating.
Yeah, and I wasn't done with the album at that point, and I was able to finish the album the way I wanted to finish it. I was able to get it mastered with the people I wanted to master it. I was able to have the people work on the art, you know, who I wanted to have work on the art, which, by the way, the cover is by a Chicagoan, Emile Ferris, who has this great graphic novel set in Chicago called My Favorite Thing is Monsters that I highly recommend. And then also I was able to put together this band that I'm on tour with, which, ironically, having made the record almost entirely myself, is the biggest band that I've ever toured with. It's like a six-piece. We have a saxophone, you know, and it's
that's great.
Yeah.
I'm just thinking about it, listening to you. It's, to me, so telling that when you're jamming a Kano and you're doing everything you can to – you're the band and you're trying to get record labels to pay attention to you. You're going city to city and you're trying to build your audience. And they come out of the woodwork to support you. Every time they come out, they buy a 7-inch or possibly come out to the show and spend money on merch. But they know they're giving to the band to help them get to another level.
Mm-hmm.
And I love how it's kind of gone full circle. Kickstarters and crowdsourcing, you got to a point where that at first was like a tech startup thing that we weren't sure about. But now it almost gives musicians that same feeling, that feeling that there once was this idea that your support would help us get somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
And now it's your support helps this artist that you love create.
Yeah, I think you're right about that. And the whole thing, I mean, the whole label model, the whole crowdfunding model is ultimately just about shared risk, you know, and mutual support. And the fact that people, you know, if you go this crowdfunding route, are able to get in on the process earlier is actually kind of cool in a way. You know, I mean, I think it's going back to speaking about labels, like, I would recommend that labels themselves figure out how to do this, you know, because
integrate it, right?
Yeah, because, right, you know, then at the end of your campaign, you know what you got and you know what you can work with, and you're going to have the ability to give people what they pledged for.
Actually, it'd be a great business model, because there's been so many terrible stories about bands that have got advances from labels, and then they have to go to tour it off, and they never actually see a dime or make a living off of the work that they've been doing. So right. You feel like this almost flip the economy of this, and yeah, say the money that's crowdsourced, you could take a percentage for the label, but the rest goes to the artist.
Yeah, absolutely.
I think that would work. I think
why
we
not,
just,
right? I know.
We just saved music, right? Ted Leo in studio. As I think about your work, you have had such a vast career being able to almost do whatever you want. And I know there's sometimes it's not that's the case, but has there ever been a time in your career that's now spanning, what, 3 or 4 decades, where you didn't feel inspired to produce the music that you wanted to produce?
No, not really.
Or that this was a job and not a passion?
Well, to answer in two parts, I've never worked with anybody who has ever pressured me to do something with my music that wasn't what I wanted to do with it. That comes, I think, partially from coming from the truly punk world, where that wouldn't even enter into anybody's head,
right,
you know,
right,
to those people growing up alongside of me and starting their own labels and continuing that ethos, you know, and also appreciating experimentation and appreciating artistry and, you know, not seeking – everybody wants to sell records, but not seeking that as the end goal of what we're doing. Right. And then to answer your second question about it feeling like a job, I mean, there is no denying that it is a grind and a half out there, you know. But the thing is, you go through the grind to get – like just take touring as one part of it. You know, you go through the grind to get to the show, and then you get to the show and you grind a little more to make the show happen. But once the show is happening, you're playing music for people.
You're in it.
Yeah, who most of the time actually want to be there to hear the music, and that's – I mean, you have to be grateful for
if you're not
for
enjoying
that, you know?
That, right?
Yeah.
You know, there's so many things to talk about, and I'm intrigued in the sense that because you have such a vast catalog of music, and because you're such a songwriter that loves to sing from the heart and sing about things, you will sing about depressing things that have happened in your life and otherwise. When you get to stage and you have to do a show and it's a Ted Leo show, people expect you to play certain songs.
Mm-hmm.
Do those songs elicit a response to you? Like, do you feel like, oh, I really want to sing this song because it reminds me of the time I was down and out. I don't really, mm-hmm. I hate this song. I really don't want to play this song, but I have to. It's just this great dichotomy when it comes to the relationship with the audience. They want to hear the stuff that you've created in the past, even though it may have been personal for you,
right.
And you don't want to revisit it.
I don't know if this is because of some talent of mine or if I'm just lucky, but I've managed to largely write songs that I have mostly not gotten sick of playing and writing the harder ones in a way that it's harder for me when I first write them. You know, like I have to get through it. Then I can sort of, you know, treat it with a little more distance.
Does the song, with the distance even there, does the song bring you back to that place when you were writing it?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah, yeah, for sure. I never really lose complete connection with things. And, you know, if those are ones that are resonating with the audience, usually that I get that feedback in the moment, you know, too. So you can't be completely disconnected from it. That said, I mean, you know, as with anything, you have to divest yourself of some emotion and so that you can perform it with the right amount of emotion and not too much emotion. You know?
Right. Well, a lot of your work is personal. It's about your life, but it's also some of it's political. Some of it is religious and your background in Catholicism and going to Notre Dame and pushing back a little bit against it.
Yeah, I was going to say it's usually anti-religious.
It's religious in the overrun.
There's a lot of religious imagery,
right,
that's
right,
for
right.
sure.
But is that important to you to be able to have commentary in your music, to be able to talk about the things that America's talking about, to talk about the big ticket items like religion or politics, things like that?
It is. I think it's both important to me to do that. And it's also just what I do, you know. I think that it's very important that we have art in the world that doesn't always deal with that sort of stuff, you know. I am very glad that, for example, in the middle of take any Curtis Mayfield album and you'll have political stuff and straight love songs, you know, like, and they both... The world would be a worse place if either of them were missing, you know. And I tend to, I think, even when I'm writing about political or social issues or something, I tend to write about them more from a personal place so that it's not a polemic. And I also appreciate polemics, you know. I mean, sometimes I need to kick myself into high gear with some old Reaganomics killing me, Reaganomics killing you, you know, kind of just like 80s, you know, political screed. But it tends to be not how I write. I write about, I was just talking about this with somebody the other day, you know, that sure, there's some stuff on this record that I wrote since the last election and is definitely informed by what's happening and where we're at, but there's really very little point in me yelling at Donald Trump, for example. Like, I'm not really writing for him, you know. I'm writing for the people who are actually listening to my music and who are trying to live through this stuff. So I don't know if that answers your question.
That does. We can't go back, right?
Yeah, exactly.
As you look forward touring this record, do you see yourself now with your refurbished studio upstairs in your home? Are you just going to be in there every night kicking out the next record? Have you found your groove?
I'm actually pretty excited to be out on the road, and I think that will be the main focus for a while now, provided I get this. We've only been on the tour for a week, and my voice is already like three octaves deeper than it usually is. But I'll get a handle on that. Yeah, I think I started at a little bit of a deficit, but I'll get back in the groove.
Right.
And that's going to continue. I mean, this tour over the course of a few different legs takes us to the middle of December. We'll be back here at Talia Hall in November, and then I imagine, we'll probably take a break over the new year and start it up again.
There you go.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Well, we love it. Ted Leo. Ted Leo and the Pharmacists, of course, a longtime indie punk band. The new album, Ted Leo's new solo album, The Hanged Man, is out now. He was just in Chicago for some shows. We'll be back in November. Ted Leo, can't thank you enough for being my guest at the Big Table.
Thank you. Thank you. Great.
Lonsdale Avenue, I'm coming back home.
Love this track. This is a good one. It's funny because we have so many great musicians that are on the show. And Ted Leo being one of the better ones that we've had on. I mean, there's great people that come through. And John Langford's on tomorrow night, which is awesome. Playing live, which is awesome. But it's one of the fun things I'm doing with my son is that on Saturdays when he's got like a camp or like a class on Saturday morning. And I'm always like, when I pick him up, I introduce him to a new song, right? And it made me think, I'm like, we should have a download playlist, right? We're going to work on that. I'm gonna do that. But every day I'm like, and it was Ted Leo on Saturday. I was like, oh, you got to hear this track. I'm listening to this music. You got to hear it. And he liked it. And before it was, there's so much great stuff that comes through here. I'm looking forward to this Saturday, maybe give him a little John Langford.
And then, 10 or 15 years from now, when he's a musician taking on the world, he'll be in an interview and he'll say, I had a class every Saturday. My dad introduced me to a lot of new music.
Ah, you're seeing what I'm seeing.
Yeah.
Or he'll be like, I hate music so much. My dad would force me to play all this.
All those old grandpa music.
Grandpa music. All I wanted was my cheat codes or Chain Smokers. that's going to be the future. There's so many bands now that are out there that my son will listen to that I'm starting to turn into such a 43-year-old dad where I'm like, this is not music. I've caught myself doing that. We did the road trip to Nashville. Playlist put together and some, Chain Smokers comes up. And I'm like, this is computers. And I'm like, I need to just, what's that? What am I doing? I can imagine what my dad said to me when I was in my Wonderlake bedroom, with the latest Public Enemy record. Burn, Hollywood, burn. That's not music. Yeah, it is, Dad. Get out of here. Chuck D and Flavor Flav. Yeah! All right, coming up tonight, we're about the halfway point of the download. Excited. Coming up, Allison Cuddy, our buddy from the Chicago Humanities Festival, is going to join us to talk about Fall Fest, which starts this weekend and goes through November 12th. There's so many great people coming to Chicago for the Fall Fest, which centers around the theme of belief. That's what they're going for. So we'll talk with Allison about that coming up here. Also, Dana Gould's going to join us, stand-up comedian and podcaster, as well as a television producer and writer for shows like The Simpsons, a little indie show. I'm not sure it's going to make it.
Did you by any chance see, I was flipping channels, I think it was on Saturday afternoon, but they ran a documentary, a mockumentary, I guess, of some sort of a very, parodied Ken Burns baseball documentary about the making of the Homer at the Bat episode.
Really? It was like one of their
It was on like at 2 o'clock in the afternoon on Saturday. Right. So I don't know like when it originally aired or, but it was just like,
was it The Simpsons doing it?
It was like it was like a Ken Burns thing. So they were talking of like very, but fake, you know, like they talked to Bob Costas and Joe Buck, and you know,
that's a great show,
but that's a great episode. I'm sure it's, you can find it on demand.
Yeah, that's good. I haven't watched the Halloween Horrors episode.
And Treehouse of Horror.
Yeah, Treehouse of Horrors. I feel like I've missed a lot of The Simpsons. I feel like because of their success and because you could see them in so many different places, especially when it comes to syndication, that I take it for granted. When new ones are on, I'm like, I'll see that one at some other point.
Yeah,
it's not as appointment viewing as it has in the past.
I mean, I used to be, you know, animation domination. I'd be watching American Dad and the Cleveland Show. You know, I wouldn't miss any of those.
And we're now, still a Bob's Burgers family. Yeah, I'll like watch an, Bob's Burgers.
Yeah, no, I don't like. I'll occasionally like if the football game is on Fox or something. I'll see like at 6 o'clock. I'll watch The Simpsons. I'm like, oh, still pretty good. You know, like after all these years, still good. But I don't. We'll watch it like a. Norm,
well, Dana Gould coming on here, so we'll talk to him about The Simpsons, but you're absolutely right. I feel like I skipped that show more than I should. And when I do sit down and watch it, I'm like, oh, this is great. And then coming up at 10 o'clock, Greg Flamm and the Swap Meet. So we got a lot to do tonight, so let's get to it. Thanks, Rob. It is The Download, 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. All right, coming up a little bit later, Dana Gould's going to join us, stand-up comedian and writer and producer for The Simpsons. He's coming to Zany's coming up here in November, so we'll talk to him. And also, Greg Flamm's going to be here a little later through the Swap Meet, where we evaluate your collectibles, your memorabilia, your junk. 312-981-7200. That's a great segment. So excited. I know people, I think we did it last week, right? We did last Wednesday. I always get confused with the Blackhawks now that sometimes we miss Wednesdays, and I'm not sure when, but I'm excited to get your calls and texts on some of the things you want to evaluate. So that's coming up in the 10 o'clock hour. Well, the Chicago Humanities Festival is about to begin their Fall Fest, which is a series of conversations and presentations around the theme of belief. The Fall Fest is presenting over 90 events and 160 presenters all through November 12th. Guests include playwright Tony Kushner, Jill Soloway, the creator of Transparent, Alan Alda, Chef Paul Kahn, and former Vice President Al Gore. Just to name drop a few. The Chicago Humanities Festival started back in 1989, you know, 28th. It's amazing to think it's been that many years. In studio tonight, Allison Cuddy, our friend, and artistic director of the Chicago Humanities Festival, which is running through November 12th. You can get all the info at chicagohumanities.org. Allison, great to see you.
It's so great to see you, Justin.
Always
thanks for having me on.
All right, so let's talk about this, because you guys have expanded. We had you on when you took over the job as artistic director, and you talked about expanding this programming over a year's time, but it still comes down to the Fall Fest.
It's still the big ticket item for us.
It's amazing to think about 90 events, 160 presenters. Are you totally stressed? Are you just like freaking out right now?
Yeah. Everyone's like drinking heavily and, you know, doing whatever they can to get through, you know, it all kicks off Saturday. It's all about the ground game now, right? With 160 people coming. I mean, many of them coming to Chicago. So like itineraries for all of them, all the travel, all of that. So yeah, there's a lot of balls in the air, but everyone's like, we've done this for what? This is our 28th. So.
I'm okay if you need it, because you know I'm on at night. If anyone's flying in during the day, I can take my CRV up to O'Hare. I can help you out.
just do a couple runs for us. That would be amazing.
If you need it.
Thank you so
much.
Let
me know if you need it. Just go ahead and let.
Stop. Give them like take them somewhere cool to get a meal. That would be perfect.
That'd be great.
Yeah.
I love it. Let's talk about the theme.
Yes.
Belief.
Yes.
Where does this come from, the idea of a festival around the concept of belief?
Right. Well, we always have a theme, and we try, especially now, to make that theme relevant to our times. And it's hard to imagine a time when we haven't had more contests over our differing beliefs. So whether you're talking about the varieties of religious experience, you know, someone was talking about Mike Pence, our vice president, the other day, you know, and he has a set of beliefs around women that are really interesting that have to do with his religious his faith. But you know, we see athletes like wanting to express their beliefs within the context of sports, and that's really interesting to us. We have a program about Muhammad Ali with Jonathan Ive.
Yeah, right. It's going to be on the show coming up next
month. So you know, there's a long history to that, to athletes like, you know, indicating what their beliefs are, or even like contesting the beliefs of the country at large, which I think is really fascinating. So there's all of that. And then there's like the whole issue of something like 10% of Americans actually believe that Congress can get anything done, like that they have value in our country.
I mean, that's a great, I really love this. I mean, especially when we're talking about it, this idea of using a big concept like belief, because you can get deep into the weeds about religion and politics, but it's also about what we believe in as a society and our values, but what we actually believe, what's a lie, what's a truth. Fake news plays into that. And then even the idea that arts and culture and the Chicago Humanities Festival, I mean, belief is always at the core of any great arts projects.
If we didn't believe, we wouldn't exist if we didn't believe that actually bringing a bunch of people together in a room and having a conversation about a difficult topic actually had some benefit for society, then, you know, where would we be? But for sure, there's so much going on right now. And so it's about faith. It's about trust. It's about what do we think the future is and how do we express that? And I just think it's such a rich topic. It doesn't really matter where your beliefs fall. There's just so much on the bubble right now that it's exciting that we're delving into that. And so,
well, why in the Fall Fest, why theme it around a theme like belief, or any, because you could just bring in some of the big names that I mentioned to do their spiel. I mean, you could have Al Gore up, you know, talking about whatever he needs to talk about, or Tony Kushner.
Right.
What is it at the Chicago Humanities Festival that you like to organize around a theme?
It's a good question. I mean, so for sure, I mean, we are trying to bring the people who are generating new ideas, right? The people who are really, if you come and hear them talk, you're going to learn something from them. They're on the cutting edge. It doesn't have to be in business or tech only. It's across all of, you know, it's in the arts, it's in science, it's in sports. But having a theme is a really interesting constraint, because as you said, we could do anything, we could bring anybody, but we kind of want to give it some coherence. And so that over the course of the next 2 weeks, if you go to one program or two, or there's some of our hardcore fans go to like 30 programs, I don't know how they do that, you're going to like walk away knowing a lot more about belief and belief as it exists in the United States, as it exists in the world, and what's shifting in that and what new ideas there are to have. And so it just sort of gives people something to focus them. I don't think it limits us, because we do bring so many different perspectives, but it does, like, so at the end of all this, you can say, so why did I do that? And that is the answer.
And a lot of these events are interviews. And you are at the helm. I mean, you're a longtime interviewer in town when you're working at BEZ and other places, and some of the people that you bring in to do that. So there is this idea that you can expand and explore and get at deeper ideas of belief. It's not just their presentation. You go, well, that was kind of about belief. I mean, you can steer it in that way.
Right, exactly. We can ask people, you know, what can they no longer believe, you know, or what are like the foundational beliefs that have driven them to where they are now? Like, I'm interviewing Al Gore. I interviewed him back in 2009, so it's a reunion. I don't think he realizes that, but for me, it's like a big moment. I'm like, Al, we're back together again. Let's talk. But I'm really curious to ask him about some of his, you know, because he's like, what a character. Whatever you think, whatever your politics are, the fact that he said, okay, I accept these results, like there's a higher, there's a higher power. In his case, it was democracy, and he's going to do this in the service of democracy. I want to talk about that.
I mean, we'll talk about all the people that you got coming through, but he's an interesting one too, because belief plays into what happens with climate change. Some people believe it's real, some people believe it's not, and he goes around, a lot of his presentations are about that. So past just what happened to him in the presidential election of 2000, his whole career is now about that concept, right?
And it's all about getting us to, and he's trying to get other people to understand that, believe that they can do something to change the situation, because it seems so dire. And after like this summer and fall where we had all these like horrible storms, we had fires raging on the West Coast, and you feel like ugh, what is going on? His message is you can still make a difference. So you yourself, you, this individual person, you, Justin Goffman, can do things to change the outcome, like that we aren't necessarily going to burn up the world, right? We can do things.
I know it's late in the game. You already have your program, and there's such great things. But I would book the entire 2005 White Sox, you know, because they had a Don't Stop Believing. That was their whole thing.
Right? That's right. Yeah, like how'd that work out?
And who wouldn't want to see Joe Creedy and Scotty Pasednik and maybe an Ozzie Guillen at the Humanities Festival?
Right? Well, we do like our sports figure.
Allison Cuddy, the Artistic Director for Chicago Humanities Festival, in studio tonight. Fall Fest is centered around the theme of belief. It begins on the 28th. It runs through November 12th. You can find out all the info on the over 90 events and 160 presenters at chicagohumanities.org. We'll take a quick break. We'll come back. We'll continue the conversation here on The Download with Allison Cuddy. Stay with us. Allison Cuddy's in studio here on The Download tonight, 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Allison, of course, the Artistic Director. Chicago Humanities Festival, Fall Fest 17, is centered around the theme of belief, bringing in over 90 events, 160 presenters. It's running through November 12th. Everyone from Tony Kushner to Vice President Al Gore, Jill Soloway, that's awesome, the creator of Transparent.
I cannot wait for that.
Right? You're interviewing on that one,
right? I am. You can relate to this. You know, the elusive get, the person that you chase.
Yes.
I've been chasing Jill for 3.5 years. I interviewed Jill a couple of times when I was still at WBEZ, and it was just like the perfect time. And all of that Jill's done, like through Transparent, through I Love Dick, you know.
Right.
How she's changed the, I think, Jill Soloway, Caitlyn Jenner, Drag Race, and then maybe like the upcoming Supreme Court battles over bathroom access have totally changed the representation of trans people in the United States, right? So, and I love that Jill's show has done that. This like mainstream television show has totally changed what people
and
understand about that life.
It's amazing, too, because the show's been so successful in the accolades, and she's from here. She's from Chicago.
She's from Chicago.
She's an Annoyance Theater person.
They are from Chicago. So one of the things, so not only does Jill care about what's on the screen in terms of representing, but behind the scenes. So one of the big things about Transparent is hiring queer people, trans people to work on the show. And then, you know, and the show is inspired by Jill's father, who made a transition from male to female. And Jill, as well, this year has now announced that they identify as they, them, there, not as she, her. So that's really interesting. I want to talk about that.
There's a lot,
But so it just, you know, being able to talk to someone who's had such a profound impact on the culture. I mean, it's one thing to bring someone who's made a hit show, but it's another thing when they've actually shifted the dialogue.
Had impact, right?
Yeah, yeah. And I think that sort of is what our MO is, what makes us different. The theme that we were talking about earlier, but also really trying to answer the, like, not just who are these people, but why they're important and why we should care about what they do.
It is interesting. I mean, even the couple names that I mentioned that are coming to the festival, to the Fall Fest, Tony Kushner, I mean, Angels in America, changed theater.
Right. In conversation with Jeremy McCarter, who was so involved with Hamilton, who has relocated to our city.
Oh, really?
So that's a great national treasure living in Chicago now.
What are you looking forward to? What are the events that, A, you're involved in, and then also stuff that you would consider to be the highlights of Fall Fest coming up here in the next couple of weeks?
Well, I'm really looking forward to Al Gore, obviously, Jill Soloway, Brooke Gladstone from On the Media. I mean, basically the woman that we trust, our media watchdog. I'm really interested in talking with her. But, you know, I think a lot of people don't know that at the festival we do a lot of, like, youth programming. And we do a whole program with teachers. It's kind of behind the scenes where we help them develop writing plans for their students. And we're bringing two YA authors. One is from Chicago, Erica Sanchez, who is a poet, but she just wrote her first novel, I Am Not Your Perfect Mexican Daughter, and it's shortlisted for a National Book Award.
Oh, great.
So she's busting out. She's from Cicero. I said Chicago, but really it's like Cicero. So, and then Jason Reynolds, who's just blowing up. This guy has written so many novels. His latest was, I'm going to forget the title, but it's essentially about a young man who's lost his brother. And so the form of the book is like an elevator ride, like in every stop, he reflects on some other aspect of his relationship with his brother. He lost his brother to drug, gun violence. And Jason writes a lot about that. And he's so interesting because he did not read a full novel until he was 17.
I saw this story this week. Yeah.
And he's been on the circuit with the book. The Long Way Down is the name of the novel. And, you know, he says, like, I'm not bragging about that. If I had read more, my life would have been better. But part of it was that he couldn't relate to what he was being asked to read. Like, he was, you know, teachers were giving him Moby Dick.
Whatever,
I can't believe
school,
that.
Right,
like, I didn't read Moby Dick in high school. I didn't read that until I was, like, you know, way older. And so, you know, he wanted to write books that young people could relate to, that would talk about things that probably were happening in their neighborhoods or to their friends. And so that's what he's done. And he's had so much success. You know, he's also, he's long listed for the National Book Award. So that's part of what we try to do. We try to bring those voices in people who are just starting to blow up, who aren't totally established yet, but, you know, it's exciting to catch them in this moment.
But they fit the narrative that you're talking about, this idea of people who are not just having success in their careers, whether they're writers or actors or creators, but they're also making an impact. They're having, they're making change.
Mm-hmm. Right.
You know, and I don't want to look past the festival. The festival's coming up, but one of the great things, and we talked about it when you were here last, is that this festival has gone from back in 1989, this was a one day, eight programs, to a festival that went over 2 weeks to now year round.
Right.
I mean, this is something that every month there are tastemakers and people who are making an impact coming to Chicago through the Humanities Festival. So how do you approach it? Do you approach this that this is your crown jewel? This is the festival. Then you get a couple weeks off to catch your breath. Or is this just another one of the programs that is all year round?
We're in the midst of doing all of this stuff for the Fall Festival, which kicks off Saturday. We're also programming next year. And one of the things that's going to change next year is we're going to announce our theme early in the year. So in February, probably. And it's going to drive our programming all year
long. Okay.
So we'll have a big kickoff event sometime in February. But we really feel like now in this age of sound bites and fake news and alternative reality, that people are yearning for that opportunity to really, like, plunge into ideas and issues and things that we know are part of the world right now. They're really changing our world and how we experience it, and looking to find other people to connect with around that, right? So, like, having this moment where you're listening to a really great talker or something like that,
in
or a great
room,
speaker.
Right.
In the same room, it's a live event, and you're like, there's that sense of communion. You're all coming together. So we felt like that the themes are, like, so powerful, and they really do tap into current day reality, that why not, like, make that organize more of our programming. So that's the plan.
I love it. Fall Fest 17 is underway starting Saturday. It's running through November 12th. You can find out all the information about the over 90 events and 160 presenters and where it's at and everything that's involved. ChicagoHumanities.org. Allison Cuddy, the artistic director of the Chicago Humanities Festival, congrats on putting this all together. And now you got to execute.
You.
Go out there and get it. Believe in yourself, Allison.
I believe in my team. They're the ones that are, like, doing it, and they are amazing. So thanks so much,
Justin.
It's always
good
great to be here.
All right. Coming up, Dana Gould's going to join us, stand-up comedian, writer, producer for The Simpsons and Stan Against Evil and IFC. Also podcaster, coming to Zany's, coming up here. Good to have Dana coming up on the show. Good to have Allison. Always great to see Allison. I just invited her. I loved her for her. She's amazing. She always was really, really, and she sits on boards and other places talking about independent film and films that are coming out and Oscars and buzz and stuff like that. She'd be good to have back, you know, with her nonchalant lifestyle or non-busy lifestyle of running a festival. Well, come on back. Come on through whenever you want. Yeah, whenever Tuesday, come through. I don't think that's going to work out, but anyway, yeah, so, but anyway, great to talk to her. I mean, that festival sounds awesome. So that's coming up, chicagohumanities.org. All right, like I said, Dana Gould coming up. Welcome back to Download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Well, my next guest is a longtime stand-up comedian who's coming to Zany's in Rosemont in early November. Dana Gould is having a pretty great year. New album, Mr. Funny Man, just came out. It's doing great on iTunes and Amazon, Kill Rock Stars. Also, his popular podcast, The Dana Gould Hour, continues, and you can see his work on the television with the premiere of Season 2 of Stan Against Evil on IFC. Gould is a stand-up, but he's also known for his television work. He worked for the better part of a decade as a writer and producer for The Simpsons and also the show Parks and Rec. Like I said, he's going to be on stage at Zany's Rosemont from November 2nd through the 4th. It's my pleasure to welcome Dana Gould to The Download. Dana, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me on. How are you?
I'm good. You get through Chicago a lot. I mean, obviously, in your career, you've done a lot of touring and played Zany's in other places.
I do. I recorded my second special at the Second City Theater there, with one of the wordiest titles in the history of comedy specials. We Put My Thoughts in You.
I love it. Yeah.
It was a great idea at the time. I thought it was a great idea.
Yeah, right. For you to be a stand-up and play different spaces, what do you like about the memories of playing Chicago?
I mean, Chicago's great. I have tons of friends from Chicago. The Odenkirk brothers, Bob and Bill and Jeff Garland, they're all a part of my Los Angeles friend Christmas card list. And Chicago was one of the comedy capitals of the country. It's an amazing, Second City and all the great stand-ups that have come from and gone through there. So Chicago's like going old home week. Plus, my very specific affinity with Chicago is I'm very good friends with, and I don't want to brag, and I'm not coming across like I'm better than anybody, but I'm close personal friends with Sven Gulli, and that is always a reason to come to town.
It's always a reason. That is a good brag. If you're gonna be friends with somebody,
brag.
Sven Gulli's the guy.
When I was on Sven Gulli, it was like, I've done a lot of stuff. The only stuff that really matters is when it's something that you're like, that you're into, it's like that you like. And when I was on Sven Gulli, I was like, hey, see, I'm something. I'm on Sven Gulli.
The new album, Mr. Funny Man, just came out. You've done several stand-up albums in your career. How do you evolve it when you have an hour's worth of material you go to put an album together? Or is it a little bit more themed?
Basically, they tend to be themed because that's just how I, develop material. You're at a certain point in your life and you're sort of work a theme throughout your material. I'm not really a scattershot. Joke about airplanes, joke about cars, joke about subway systems. I have a sort of a theme in my act. So the album, you perfect an hour of material, about an hour of material, and then that's the once you get it sharp. And the interesting thing is you can feel it get ready, and then you can feel it, like, get rot. Like, there's definitely a time when, like, the time to record this is now. And this album, I've been touring, and then I was just getting ready to go to Atlanta for the summer to shoot Stan Against Evil, my show. And there was talk about, well, let's do it as a special. We'll do it on Netflix, blah, blah, blah. But all of that stuff was off like 3 months down the road because I was leaving. I was like, no, this stuff's ready to go now. And I just did it as an album.
And that's interesting to hear because I would assume that there's such lag time when you're trying to schedule what is, a special, especially for something like HBO or Comedy Central or Netflix.
Yeah, there is lag time, and I didn't have it. And I was like, this stuff's not going to, by the time I take 3 months off to film the show and then go back on the road, get back up to speed, a lot of this stuff's going to be kind of meh. And I felt that I grabbed it right at the right time. I'm really, obviously I think every album I do is better than the one before because I think my writing only improves. And now I'm excited about the new batch of material. I have almost 41 seconds of new material that I'll be premiering.
You have had such a prolific career, both on stage and, of course, on television with your work writing for television and also on screen. But,
showing up where they forget to fire me.
but as a stand-up comedian, and there's always, you always find that stand-up comedians make that transition into being writers. I think about a lot of the writers that are on The Simpsons or Parks and Rec. But talk about that, because that's not that's not necessarily easy transition, because you write one way for the stage and one way for the sitcom or for television, and they're not similar except for maybe your point of view.
Well, I think it's true. What the thing that happened with me was the natural transition as you go from being a stand-up to being an actor, even though they're very different disciplines. One is about talking and one is about listening. It's also the difference between being on a date and being married. What happened with me is I had written a couple of I had a couple of deals for pilots, and they connect you with a writer, and the writer kind of goes and watches you perform and talks to you, and then comes back with, you know, a pilot idea. There, you're a, you know, guy living with his single dad, and you own a coffee shop, and it's crap. And I just got tired of sitting with these guys and watching them write my story. And I was like, let me just do it. And I just wrote one called On Spec. I just kind of sat down and did it, and it ended up getting made. It didn't go to series, but it got made. And I found that I liked the writing process as much, if not a little bit more, than acting. And I, you know, it's a different discipline, but I really enjoyed it. And I felt that it used the muscles that I use in stand-up more. The trick is, especially when you go on a show like The Simpsons, is that you really have to be able to put your ego in a box and forget about it. You know, when you're touring and you're on the road and you're not a celebrity, but you're a little, you're the show, you know? And when you're a part of a much bigger enterprise, no one cares. And deservedly so, you know, nor should they have to. And you really have to be able to put that aside and just realize that, you know, you're a part of a much bigger endeavor.
And I think about the balance as well as a performer. If you're an actor and a stand-up and a writer and you have all these things going at once, is that difficult to, obviously, you know, when the bounty's there, it's there, and that's awesome for your career, and you've had so many things going on. But is it difficult to find that balance about what material goes here and how much time you spend on the writing and getting out there and pounding the pavement for acting? Do you have to think about balance?
I do not pound the pavement for acting. I don't think of myself as an actor. I think of myself as a stand-up comedian who writes and as a writer that does some acting. But I, you know, 90% of the acting that I do is either stuff that I've written for myself that I do, mm-hmm. or things that friends, I'm doing a movie in December that a friend of mine said, hey, will you do this? Sure, I'd love to. I get shot. Great, I'm in. I don't really pound the pavement for it. I work more, you know, the reason I do so many things, like even with the podcast additionally, I also look at it as it's harder to hit a moving target. And the more fires that you have going, you become less dependent on any one thing. And there's some freedom in that I like. I'm also, I like to work, you know, so that works for me too. I like to, you know, I like to write. I like to sit down with a blank screen and create something. And to me, stand up in the podcast, although there's a lot of work involved, that's just a fun outlet. You know, I'm actually at a really exciting point now because the album did just come out, and it came out, and then I took 3 months off to do the show. So I'm putting a lot of new stuff into the act now. There are pieces from the album in the act that I think are significant that people sometimes want to hear, big contemporary things. But, you know, it's just sort of like a rebuilding year for your baseball team. So I find this is a really exciting time to go out and perform and really be open to expanding, you know, your act and finding that new hour.
Yeah, and a lot of your work, it's so great. I mean, obviously in this digital age where I can type your name into YouTube and I can find clips from old shows and things that I remember and comedy routines.
I've been around so long, you can see me acting with animals that are now extinct.
The beauty of it, though, is to watch that you have been very consistent in the kind of comedy that you've done on stage. You are you a lot of jokes about yourself, a lot of jokes about relationships. I mean, even in the record, the album you just put out, you're talking about anxiety earlier times you're talking about marriage. Now you're talking a little bit about divorce. There's a lot in there that is when you talk about
it. Like a real beautiful journey.
Right. About putting that ego in a box, right?
Well, yeah, but it is, you know, as like I've said, like with my marriage, I don't have a lot of successes, but I have the world's most interesting failures.
That's a good thing, right?
That's sort of the angle. Yeah, well, I've always, that's just the way, you know, that's just the way I happen to write. That's just the way that I find sort of like my, the best way to do it for me.
Yeah.
Everybody develops their own style after a while. And I think that I have a high, you know, I have a hybrid of like, you know, I'm not comparing myself to these people in any way, shape or form, but I'm showing you how they influenced me. Like the way Richard Pryor would talk about his self, the way George Carlin would talk about the world, and the way Albert Brooks would talk, period. I took that sort of introspection, that extrospection, and then I gave it his delivery, and that's sort of how I developed my shtick.
Yeah, that's a tremendous recipe right there. Before I let you go, the IFC show, Stand Against Evil, I'm interested because you said it's a hidden comedy and a horror show. You've been able to sort of blend genres. Is this the best representation of Dana Gould and the things that you've done in your career?
This is the best representation of the stuff that I love. Like, this is a show that I would watch if I didn't create it. And how it came about was I did a pilot call that was based on the premise of what if my dad had to come and live with my wife and myself and our kids. And I've described my dad in the past quite accurately as Archie Bunker without the elegance and sophistication. So I had this idea and we shot it. The pilot shot for ABC. It did really well. Brian Dennehy played my dad. He was brilliant. Actually went to meet him in Chicago where he was performing Kraft's last tape. And the show got made, but it didn't get to series. But I saw that character worked. I saw that somebody playing that kind of character worked. And I thought, well, what if a better idea would be, what if I just did a show that he did not belong in and just put him in the middle of it?
Yeah.
You know, what kind of shows do I watch? I don't watch comedies because I'm a comedian. I don't want to go home and look at what I do all day. I watch horror shows. I'm friends with Sven Gulli. I love horror movies. I love The X-Files. I love The Night Stalker, if you remember that. So what if I write a show like that and then just put my dad in the middle of it and everybody would have to deal with him? And it was just this gruff guy that didn't, it's not that he didn't believe in this stuff. He believed in it. He just didn't care. And that was the origin of the show. It was actually quite that simple. It was just like, what if you took David Duchovny off The X-Files and replaced him with Carol O'Connor from All in the Family? But it still was The X-Files. And that was the show. And I was very, very lucky to get John McGinley from Scrubs to play the lead, play Stan.
Great.
And
yeah.
Janet Varney from You're the Worst is the co-star. And I was really, really happy. It did really, really well. And we get to do a second season. And it premieres November 1st.
Dana Gould is going to be at Zany's in Rosemont, November 2nd through the 4th. He's got his new album out, Mr. Funny Man, just came out. Dana, a pleasure to talk with you. Thanks so much for sharing stories and taking some time out tonight to talk to us. We appreciate it.
Oh, man, my pleasure. Thanks for having me on. I look forward to seeing you guys on Rosemont.
Good to have Dana Gould on the show. Always fun. I love it. I love that he does such great stand-up, and it's fun to watch his clips because that anxiety and the he does a whole special on divorce, but that anxiety just kind of plays out. And you know what? There's something great, and comedy is real, and the best jokes are in the real, and he does a great job of mining that. So Dana Gould at the Zany's in Rosemont coming up here in early November next week. All right, coming up, swap meet. All right, I'm excited. Greg Flamm in the building at DuPage Picker. 312-981-7200. What do you got? What do you want to brag about tonight? What's some of the memorabilia you found? Maybe you had to go up to the attic, you know, to caulk the windows, put some more insulation in as the cold weather comes through. And you're like, oh, look at this. An old Playboy. Whatever it is. Oh, look, an old toy car still in the package. I wonder what this is worth. I know. I'll ask WGN.
There, a couple of weeks ago, there was the Vintage Garage, which they have up in Edgewater, like once a month, and they had a special, like a vinyl one, in a couple of weeks ago. So we walked over there, and I'm just kind of looking around. They have Christmas things, tons of stuff, I always want to buy every Christmas thing. Yeah, I just want
of course
10. I want like 15 light up Santas. So I want it all. By refrain, I'm like, I can't do this now. It's only October. But then I was kind of browsing a records area, and I kind of looked over, and I saw a bunch of Playboys. And I was like, ooh. And I was like, do I go over there and, like, page through them?
Like, what do you do? You browse to see if this is worth it.
Yeah, I wasn't hilarious. Sure about what to do. I was like,
I'll examine these without opening.
Yeah.
Right? Is that what you have to do? Yeah. I feel like I've been in a couple of thrift stores, vintage shops, where there has been a collection of Playboys in the back, and it's always the same. We're like, well, that's interesting. I'm not actually going to be the sucker who walks over there and be like, ooh, let's thumb through this. Although that'd be a great bit.
Well, you gotta find some old Sports Illustrateds and then put the Playboy in the Sports Illustrated. Right. Let's do that.
You know, I was, when we went to Nashville this weekend, there was, on the way down, we drove down and we got closer to Nashville. There's this great moment where, and Greg's going to be mad at me, but there's a great moment where there was an accident downtown Nashville. They were having some construction accident. So there was like a buildup. So the GPS calmly tells you to take a different route. And so we did it, and it was winding. It was beautiful. It was gorgeous. You get into the winding roads, country area of Nashville for a stretch. Then you get to the, like, okay, we're, you know, now I'm just on Butterfield Road of Nashville. And there's a, you know, there's a, I don't even know what the restaurants would be, a Fazoli's. And you're like, okay, this looks like everything. There's a Fazoli's, Nashville Fazoli, the suburbs of Nashville. It's just like, all right. But when we were doing the winding roads, there were these great, you know, white picket fence, almost Southern Mansion type farm place, things like that. And there was a series of, it was Friday afternoon, Friday night, and there were a series of garage sales. And they were just like, they just looked like they were ripe. There were just tons of swap meet stuff. And I was on time. I was, this was hour seven, you know, of this trip. And I was just like, I was huzzing through the Route 10 or whatever, skipping it. I'm like, oh, that would have been cool. Like, is that kind of stuff? It would have been great if I had the wherewithal, if I had an extra 20 minutes to run in there and just pick something random so I could bring it back for the swap meet and be like, look what I found in Nashville. What's this worth? Nothing. It's a original Fazoli's menu. That was good. All right, 312-981-7200 is the phone number. I want a lot tonight. There's a lot we can go through. We can go through Halloween stuff, right? We could do that. We, of course, sports, the World Series would be a big thing. The Cubs are, of course, not playing this year. But the White Sox, I thought that someone just put up a text that said that they believe that tonight is the anniversary of the 14-inning Scott Pesednik home run game that was against the Astros. I mean, I could look that up easily, but I'm not going to because I'm lazy.
Were there a couple of extra inning? There was a Jeff Blum. Was that an extra inning game too? That might have been the Scott Pesednik happened at some point this week for sure, like yesterday or today, because I remember seeing some newscast show the highlight.
I think that the big there was because Pesednik. I mean, that was a 0-0 game, wasn't it?
Yeah, 1-0, right?
Yeah, and Scotty Pesednik hits the home run.
No home runs all year during the season.
It's amazing. Yeah, but if you got something from the White Sox, something from the Cubs, we'll take some Bears stuff. See if Greg's got a poster. I personally, I mean, I think I'd like to see some more. I love the, you know what? If people have this would be great. I watched the Ken Burns Vietnam, right? And they had a whole 25 minutes or so dedicated to the 68 Democratic Convention, which coming up next year will be 50 years. But it was just footage that I hadn't seen from different angles. Like it was great to see close up. And there was I just know that there was a lot of memorabilia and stuff left behind and collectibles that people have. So if you have any of that stuff, That's what I'm looking for, right? A little Chicago history. You got anything from the amphitheater? Like right away, just the amphitheater. I've got the word amphitheater. Awesome. I'll take it. All right, so coming up, 312-981-7200. It's the Swap Meet with Greg Flamm.
It's time for Swap Meet. Oh, yeah, here we go. Oh, another man's junk is another man's treasure, like a gold tape measure. When you were a kid and your fingers in your nose, today you're a picker. Or it could be comic books or silverware. As long as it's old, has no mold, there's value there. It's time for Swap Meet with Justin Kaufman
and Greg Flamm.
Here we are.
Here we are. It's time for the Swap Meet here on Wednesday night, 312-981-7200 with my man Greg Flamm. He, of course, at DuPage Picker. He's on the show. He's ready to evaluate your collectibles, your memorabilia, your junk. 312-981-7200. Greg, always great to see you, buddy.
Yeah, always fun.
I know with the Blackhawks games, we get a couple of weeks. Yeah. We weren't on last week. I don't think we'll be on next week, but it's always great to have you here.
It's good to have a break.
And the stuff that you bring.
Gives me time to think of some cool stuff to bring in. I think I stepped it up tonight.
I think you did. I turned all the lights off in the studio just for the experience of what you brought tonight.
Well, a couple weeks ago, I went to an estate sale, and they had a ton of posters, and I got a couple Blacklight posters, but I also got a bunch of other posters, like Rush and the bands that really sell fast, and posters are just big money. I mean, I've sold some as high as $350, $600,
what?
And I've gotten them for like a dollar at these estate sales, and today, brought in... I had a Led Zeppelin, and this is Guns N' Roses. The Led Zeppelin sold fast for $45, got it for a dollar. This one also got for a dollar, and it's about a $30 poster.
Oh, my gosh. Look at this thing. It's is that an Appetite for Destruction? Yeah. Guns N' Roses, Black Lights. Yeah. Look at that thing.
Use
my favorite
illusion.
Is that you have to plug it in. And what year would you say this is? 87?
Yeah, that's like 87.
87, so you gotta plug it in, you gotta put the blacklight bar over it, right? So it shines, it's almost mirror-like.
Yeah, they made, obviously, it's sold separately, you get your own blacklight, and they just, hundreds of these posters were made, different kinds. So here, what we're gonna do, our weekly news segment should be, run down in your basement to see if you have any of this stuff.
I don't, I wish I did.
So I'm pricing these, right, and I'm just punching in, like, vintage blacklight posters. And I'm seeing some of the 1971 Marvel ones, like Spider-Man, Silver Surfer, Doctor Strange. They've gone for like $800 to $1,000.
Blacklight or just
Blacklight,
going,
yeah.
Wow.
So, yeah, if you have any of those Blacklights. But the other one that are just huge are like Led Zeppelin, of course, your classic rock bands.
Right.
Led Zeppelin, Kiss. And I was telling you off here that I had that Kiss Blacklight poster. It's going for $350 now, and I had it as a kid, of course. So.
Your stoner teenage life.
Yeah,
could actually,
reliving.
You could benefit from it if you just go down in the basement and be like, oh, man, I had that Guns N' Roses Blacklight poster.
Yep.
Look at that thing. Wow.
So yeah.
Wow. So, lighting up Michigan Avenue here in the studio. I love it.
And then going with the like light psychedelic light thing, is I have this actual box that was made in Japan and in, trying to think the date of it, but yeah, probably late 60s, early 70s, but... This box, you could actually plug in any light into it. It has a regular outlet, but you would actually take your speaker leads out of your stereo system and plug this or twist the speaker leads in the side, and then hit a knob, and
it would just make the whole house
dim. Yeah, it would just kind of dim and just create this like mood lighting to the music, right? Yeah, so it was kind of cool.
It's like something that you would find in Quagmire's house.
Right. Of course, you know, you need the lava lamp,
right,
of course, and the motion, that one bar thing.
We have simulated the ocean wave. Lights off in the studio so that the passerby the studio will get to see this beautiful, the Guns N' Roses. It's the classic cross with the skeleton heads. But I love my favorite part about it, which has nothing to do with the Blacklight poster, but my favorite part about it is like, well, they got to keep the long hairstyles.
Right.
Like,
right.
You can't just, you know, like, Slash has got the hat on.
Yeah.
And great stuff.
You know, so this poster is about a $30 poster, but
30
still
bucks,
for
I
a dollar.
$250
you know,
for it.
Yeah, you know.
It feels like it'd be a $250-er.
Yeah, I was hoping, of course, because I knew Blacklight posters, you know, even just the psychedelic designs ones, they don't have to be a rock band. Those are still like in the $50, $60, yeah.
All right, well, there you go. Starts us off, 312-981-7200. If you got some blacklight posters, yeah, posters of Guns N' Roses.
See who ran in their basement or attic.
Who's down there getting the good stuff.
Right.
All right, let's get right to it. Let's get Dan on the phone. Dan, what do you want to brag about, Dan?
I got a pair of 1968 press passes for the Democratic National
Convention.
Yeah,
Now we're talking. This is what I had called out at the 10 o'clock at the beginning of the news to say that this is what I want to hear about. Where'd you get them?
I found them when I was a kid in a paper drive in the early 70s. I had them ever since, and I always thought they'd be worth just gobs of money.
Wow.
I wonder, I mean, that's probably the most famous political convention in American modern American history, because I'm sure people would argue, say, well, what happened in 1930? but the idea of that being the one that everybody knows because of all the tumult that was outside of it. I mean, but that does
I wanted Abby Hoffman to autograph.
Yeah, right? That would have been awesome.
Right. I can't find any sold. There are two available right now online, and they're only asking $21 for it. Each.
See what I mean? You know, you think they'd be worth big money. But,
I know, and that's a common theme with this show. It's always like, these blacklight posters are worth $1,000, but these Democratic Convention 1968 passes are only $20.
I was hoping for $100 apiece.
Yeah, you know, you might want to, you know, if you are going to sell them, just wait for these two to
what
sell,
they,
and you
what
can probably
say,
ask a little more.
What's the picture on it? Is it a picture of Chicago, or is it a picture of Daly? Like, I just picture
There's no picture.
I would think that the press pass would, like, laminate Daly's face on it. That's what Chicago was like in the 60s.
I can show you.
I kept my press passes because I went to, I covered the 1996 Democratic Convention for Bill Clinton for his reelection campaign back in 96 at the United Center. Okay, there it is. Yep, yep, $21. And then I also did 2008 for Obama, but that stuff's probably worth less than this, I would assume.
I got two Spiro Agnew watches, too.
Oh, okay.
There you go.
That's probably worth more than 20.
All right, thanks, Dan.
I really want to... Okay, thanks, bye.
Thanks.
The best thing I will remember about the 1996 Democratic Convention, right? We were doing live broadcasts out of that place. It was in the United Center, Bill Clinton, whole thing. But they had, because Daly was really putting on all the stops, they had a room in the United Center that was the media room for food. You get food. And they put everything in there. It was hot dogs, Italian beef,
pizza,
deep dish pizza.
Nice.
You would think that I had not eaten in 6 months.
Well, you know.
I went in there, I was like, hot dogs?
So you have to tell me, are like news press, are they more savage with the food, you know, like the spread than sports?
Yeah, writers? Probably the same.
The same, okay.
I mean, and usually you'd find your own, like, because when I went in 2008, I just got my own food. There was no food to be given.
Right.
But for whatever reason, he had set that out for the press. I remember that. And I remember us being like, this is free?
Yeah.
And it was hot. It was just like classic Chicago food. But it was awesome. What he was like delivering to the national media, and us local guys are like, I was probably 22 years old. And I was like, oh,
this is how it's going
to
be.
Nine hot dogs so I don't have to eat for the next month. I just remember.
Nice.
So, Greg Flamm in studio. It's the Swap Meet, 312-981-7200. We'll come back. We got some great stuff. Roger Badish also in the house. I didn't know he was here. We can talk to him about it. He just raided his garage or something because he put up on Facebook all this stuff. So we'll talk with Roger as well. 312-981-7200. Stay with us. It's a swap meet here, 312-981-7200. Greg Flamm at DuPage Picker in studio with his Guns N' Roses blacklight poster, which is just shining bright. All right, let's get to some of the texters and calls. 312-981-7200. 630 says, I've got a panther, a ceramic panther, which is a mid-century from my husband's grandmother. And it's essentially just a... It's exactly that. It's a ceramic panther.
Yeah, they're very iconic of, you know, mid-century modern.
They are.
And they made different sizes. They range from, you know, 50 to 200. So depending
on the size,
which size you have.
That's really what it's going for?
Yeah.
So you're telling me the ceramic panther is more than the black
Yeah, and
poster
honestly,
from Guns
N' Roses? I think
What's
it's
wrong with the society,
it could be marble or something heavier than ceramic. I think it's I don't know, but maybe the $50 ones are ceramic, that's why they're less. You know.
All right.
But I do see them quite often, so
really?
They're not that rare, you know.
Hmm.
Yeah.
I don't see that. I mean, I guess it's decorative if people
yeah,
are like,
they're
welcome
pretty
to
common,
my house.
Yeah.
Do you like my ceramic panther? Yeah. 630 says, I have a pair of shoes. They're called spring shoes.
Mm-hmm.
What's the value of a spring shoe? Spring shoes, it's essentially that. They're two shoes that are on springs, maybe for clowns or something?
Yeah, bouncing, yeah. It was probably around the time the pogo stick, you know, type craze. Oh. But, you know, they're way less than I thought they would go for. They're 25 to 40, but the people who sold those did buy it now. I really think if you did an auction on that, you get much more than 40 for those. So if that person is going to sell them, do an auction instead of buy it now. And they'll make a little more, I think.
Okay.
Undervalued.
773 says they have a 1930s poster, Black Sambo, which is the, I guess that's straight up racist stuff.
Yeah.
That racist art, right? Is there a category on eBay for racist art?
I think they file it under Americana type stuff.
It's like the lawn jockey type stuff? Yeah. Like that same
thing? You won't see too much of that. I think they kind of banned that on eBay, but you will see like Black Sambo, you will see like Aunt Jemima, you know, bottles, stuff like that, and they file that kind of under.
Is there a market for that? Do people go crazy?
Yeah, there is. There's no way around that. And
is it like racist that love collecting racist memorabilia, or is it more like people with the fascination of
I think
that
it's more
time?
The fascination. I think it's reflective of the time. I've seen people who do collect it, and I wouldn't categorize them as racist. So I think it's more a collectible thing.
Not just something to like.
Yeah. And I would, I couldn't find a poster. There were obviously a lot of books, you know, for Black Sambo, but no posters. So I think, you know, if you're going to sell it, I would start at 200 auction, and you might get way more than that. That's, you know, there's no other competition.
All right. I found some of Roger Badish's stuff.
Okay.
This is what he's got up on Facebook. He'll join us in a second.
Sure.
Okay. So he's got a radio guide from September of 1939.
Yeah,
this is a precursor to the TV Guide, same publisher of the TV Guide, but it was a radio guide for programs that would be on the radio in 1939. Pretty cool, red, you know, and with a.
Well, here's the one. Did he say he had how many? 1,000 of them, or how many?
No, I think he's got one.
Oh, okay.
It says 1,001 programs.
Oh, okay.
So it's like, yeah.
Well, here's the one he wants to get is the Judy Garland one from that era, 1930s. That one is the highest at $30 just for the one. On average, though, they go for $5 to $10 each. So
what?
Yeah. But it looked like there were
quite a radio guide from 1939 goes for $5.
It looked like there
were
a lot of them online, so somehow people saved those.
Did you hear that, Roger? I would think that he'd be getting $50, $75, $100, $150, something like that.
I want him to get that much for him. You know, but
$5.
$5 to $10, yeah.
I don't know. Roger's going to be upset when he hears this.
Yeah.
We'll get him on when he comes in. But
his Dave Kingman mug might be worth more than that.
All right. Earlier, speaking of the WGN family, I was talking about the swap meet at the crosstalk with Roe. And Roe Khan said he had a 1978 jacket from the Who tour.
That's awesome.
And it was something about a flood, but he got it redone.
Wow.
He's feeling better about it. He just got it back because he had lost touch with whoever had it.
Okay.
But how much, what's a 1978 Who tour jacket go for?
Yeah, I couldn't find that exact year, but here's how you can kind of tell. Like, if the jacket is satin, it's going to be worth more like $400 to $500 and up if it's satin. If it's just kind of a standard jacket, maybe it has the stripes along the waist and the wrist has like those elastic stripes. If it's more like that, the Who jackets are about $200, but if it's satin, it's easily more than $500.
Well, if I know Roe Khan, I know he is exclusively satin. Like that's all he works in.
500 plus.
I mean, he is flowing satin. His pants are satin. He's wearing his undershirts are satin.
All right,
he's a satin kind of guy. So, yeah, he's big money. I'll tell him tomorrow. That's great.
Yeah, hopefully we'll be happy with that.
There you go. Roger Badish, I see you up there. Okay, so we were going over your radio guide that you put up on Facebook. Before we get to the stuff that you put up this week, what were you doing? Were you just cleaning this stuff out? Like you just want to get rid of it? What are you doing?
Yeah, I'm decluttering my life. We've got way too much stuff in our place from the decades of everything. So I'm clearing everything out.
How do you make the choice of what to keep and what to get rid of?
If I can't figure out what it is because of the layers of dust on it, it goes.
Right.
If somebody else would get better enjoyment out of it than I have been able to for the last 20 years because I've never used it in 20 right. years, then it goes. If it's stuff that really doesn't hold a strong sentimental value to me and someone else can use it, then it goes. If it's stuff that I just know nobody's going to use, it goes in the dumpster.
So, where does the stuff that you don't want to throw away, where are you going to put it?
The stuff I don't want to throw away, I'm either giving away. I've got like 9 boxes of ornaments and trinkets that I'm going to be mailing out to people from Facebook asked that they wanted it. I've replaced batteries in some of these where it hasn't been used in so long, the batteries have corroded, so I've had to clean it out. The stuff that I really, really don't want, I've documented on Facebook that I know I'm never going to use again. I've documented as much as I could, and then it goes. I'm now on my 10th 30-gallon garbage bag.
Wow.
Well, you heard what Greg said is that your radio program that you put up is worth about $5.
Yeah.
Five to ten on average. The Judy Garland issue is the high one at 30.
Okay.
There's that.
Yeah. And I got it at an antique shop, actually, when I found a couple of other things from my high school and everything. And I thought it was pretty cool, knowing that I love old-time radio and everything.
Right.
But again, TV Guide, published by Annenberg, who goes on then to do TV Guide and now provides these Annenberg grants all over the world to journalists, to TV productions, PBS. So he was the publisher of it and actually wrote stuff in there.
Okay.
And that full page ad for TV sets, this again is September 1939. TV was introduced by NBC, RCA, in 1939 at the World's Fair.
Wow.
But then because when the U.S. got into the war, the development of television was frozen by the FCC.
Wow.
So this TV ad is very, very unique.
And it's worth $5.
Yeah, I know. So,
and we've talked about sometimes the ads in magazines are worth more than the whole magazine itself. We've talked about that.
So unique.
Yeah.
So you might want to save that just for that.
The Guns N' Roses blacklight poster we have down here, that's worth $35.
Right.
The 1939 radio guide, that's $5.
And that happens a lot on Swap Meet.
The irony.
It is. All right. 312-981-7200. Roger Badish giving us a little update there. Greg Flamm in studio at DuPage Picker. We'll do the second half of the Swap Meet coming up here. We got some good stuff that's coming up on text. If you want to join in, 312-981-7200. Stay with us.
It's time for Swap Meet. Oh, yeah, here we go. Oh, another man's junk is another man's treasure, like a gold tape measure. When you were a kid and your fingers in your nose, today you're a picker. Or it could be comic books or silverware. As long as it's old, has no mold, there's value there. It's time for Swap Meet with Justin Kaufman
and Greg Flamm.
Here we are.
Here we are at DuPage Picker, both on Facebook and Twitter. It is time for Swap Meet, the second half. 312-981-7200. Let's start us off with Tom. Tom, what do you want to brag about, Tom?
Hey, I got a 1910 die wheel.
Awesome.
By H.C. Higgins.
What is that? What's a die wheel?
It's a big, like a gambling wheel, right. Yep,
like for roulette? Is that what you mean?
Yeah, it was kind of like for back in the early days of like Prohibition and stuff like that, they probably used them. You know, it was kind of illegal type gambling. And it depends how complete your wheel is, so describe it to me.
It's in really nice shape. There's no cracked mirrors on it.
Okay.
I do have the original shipping crate that it came in.
Oh, that's awesome.
Completely round, all wood.
Yeah. In that condition, I mean, you probably are looking over $2,000.
What?
Yeah. That's why I asked the condition, because some people are selling just like the top part of the wheel, and that alone is getting $250. So that's why I wanted to see how complete yours was. But what makes yours even more than what I think could be $2,000 is the fact you have the shipping crate. So that's awesome.
Wow. Value.
Yeah, that's
there
awesome.
There you go, the big winner. Ding,
yep.
ding.
All right, appreciate
winner.
It.
Thanks for calling.
Chicken dinner. Thanks, Tom.
Thanks.
There you go. Wow, there you go. We were talking about the, again, I still think the Blacklight Guns N' Roses poster may more value than the gambling wheel, but who am I?
Just you, yeah.
Society says otherwise.
Right.
All right. 847 had sent a picture of, I think, and I am so sorry, it's a watch. Looks like it's from the 60s, and it's either got, Sleeping Beauty had the blonde hair, right? Sleeping Snow White's had the black hair?
Yep.
right?
Right.
So I think it's a Sleeping Beauty. Sleeping yep. Beauty watch. So she's on it almost like a Mickey Mouse watch, but it's Sleeping Beauty.
Yeah,
it's
I found still the ticking. Exact one. That's
still
awesome.
Oh, yeah? Is it Sleeping Beauty?
Yeah, and...
oh, I'm so proud of myself.
Yeah, it looks like a brand called Ripka.
Okay.
Like Kelly Ripka, and we digress. And it's going for about $80, but I'm not sure if that's working or not working. So if hers or the person's
yeah,
is working, could be worth more than that.
How
if
much,
they have
80?
The box, it could be worth more as well. It could be in wow. 150 range with the box.
All right.
So we're good.
Yeah. All right. So let's keep going here. 773 says they have an original clay mold of one of the kills from the Friday the 13th series. What does that mean?
Yeah, I'm assuming that was some kind of prop from the movie or some kind of material that they used to make one of the parts for the movie is what I'm thinking. It's that authentic. And it's because I'm not finding anything. Yeah. This is clay mold.
I love that you take it, or I automatically go, yeah, they're just doing
yeah, it's
a bit
a bogus
that
call,
I don't
right,
get,
right.
right? But yeah, I guess one of the kills from Friday the 13th, an original clay mold.
Right.
I just love the idea. They're like, well, remember the woman who killed and was killed by the chainsaw in the shed? Let's make a clay mold
right.
of her.
Yeah, I'm thinking it made the rubber mold, you know, like the clay was the outer mold and made the rubber part that they used in the kill scene is what I'm guessing from it.
Yeah, okay.
So if they want to call or text with more info.
Yeah. 312 says, my aunt had a handwritten letter from Albert Schweitzer written in French. This yeah. one, 312, Albert Schweitzer.
Yeah, I'm not able to find letters, but just a signed book by Albert Schweitzer is like 180, you know. So a letter, you know, depending on the content of the letter, condition, things like that, could be a few hundred dollars.
Really?
Yeah, I mean, if a signed book by him is 180.
I will say this. I'm a little disappointed in the Swap Meet Faithful tonight that nobody has any Blacklight posters.
Yeah.
That's to rival the Guns N' Roses yep. poster that's in studio.
Yep. It kind of shows you how rare they are. And I mean, if they're
if
getting
I
that
were
much money.
If I were going to make Blacklight posters in 2017, I would make them, but I would make them almost like they do with greeting cards, where you can hit a button and you can hear the music as well.
Yeah, I mean, they should make them like with fiber optics. They should just make them a little thicker. And I mean, why am I saying this? I
should
just patent that and just do that, right?
It's patented. That's right. Whenever you talk
about it. Erase that tape, Pete.
When you talk about it on AM radio, it's automatically patented.
Right, there you go.
Like if you hit the button, it was like,
right, and it could play a tune and kind of do the fiber optic, like Easter Bunny stuff that they have out there.
Yeah. Right. A lot you can do with posters. I feel like poster technology needs to step up their game.
They do.
Because you see this and you're like, this is the future. Blacklight posters is the future. Now, obviously, that technology died in the 80s, but there should be new poster technology.
Yeah, I mean, I did want to talk a little bit about just how life was in the 70s. You turned on your Blacklight poster. You opened the centerfold to Houses of the Holy by Led Zeppelin. You put the vinyl on the turntable. You had to flip it over for side two. I mean, just all
and
the...
Just, and then all you did is just lifted weights.
And, you know, yeah, and we were happy. And, you know, that was...
Yeah. And then you just
these kids these days with their MP3.
You had your weight bench, and you just
right.
pounding iron,
right? You know, you got your drum set maybe in a laundry room or something. Yeah.
All right, 312-981-7200. Jerry's got a good one here. Life Magazine from May 9th, 1955.
Okay.
Life Magazine, titled at the top, we got Great Religions Part 4: The World of Islam. The cover features a red dressed young woman with a veil all in red against a background of a sand dune. The bottom text says, Islam, girl in Pakistan. The mag is in a plastic and it's brand new condition, and I think it's topical, being able to read Life's assessment 60-plus years later.
Sure, and you would think so, and there are so many of them available.
Really?
And I am not finding any sold. I mean, so that's kind of bad news.
But is Life Magazine one of those that everybody wants to put those up?
Yeah, it's one of those things you find in the garage. You're like, oh, this has to be worth something because it's from 1955. And unfortunately, that's not the case a lot of times.
Right.
I know like Look Magazine and some of the other ones have the better ads in them, and that's what we talk about. Some of the car ads from back in the day, the one page will sell for $15. And you find like a Look Magazine has like 15 cool ads in it and at $12 a pop. And you made like almost $100 on the magazine, you know? Just from single-page ads. But, yeah, Look, though, didn't, or not Look, but Life, the magazine they're talking about didn't really have the greatest ads. And
ads is the way to go.
Yeah, yeah, that's really kind of what you're looking for when you're at estate sales or garage sales. Look at the ads more than the actual magazine sometimes.
847 says, I've got the Blacklight poster, the butterfly of love that hung in the Brady Bunch girls' room.
Nice.
That's great. See, now we're getting somewhere.
Yeah, and that's the kind I was talking about. They were just more like the psychedelic drawing Blacklight posters,
right,
you know. And I was happy to have that 70s show on this morning, and
they had one of those.
He had the Blacklight poster, and he had one of the psychedelic ones.
When I was in Nashville this weekend, I was going into a couple of the restaurants and the bars. They had the crushed black velvet Elvises.
Yeah, we've talked about that.
Yeah,
yeah. I had to come across a Pink Panther one.
Well,
black,
there you go.
You know, velvet painting of.
Now here they all come. Here we go. 847 says they have the Led Zeppelin Swan Song Blacklight poster from the 80s.
Yeah, that's the one I sold. $45.
Really?
Yeah, it was a Swan Song.
$45. There
yep.
you go. Now we're getting somewhere.
Yeah, it's always like that. 10 o'clock. Or right. 11.
Yeah, exactly. Let's go to Oren. Oren, what do you want to brag about, Oren?
Yes, I've got a 17-foot Morningstar, very lightweight fiberglass canoe. Made about 10 years ago now, I think. And it's very stable compared to most canoes when it's on the water. It's got a special build on the sides so that it doesn't tip over easily.
So it's just really a 10-year-old canoe?
Yeah, it's called Morningstar.
Okay.
Huh.
I can't think of the maker's name, but I'm sure if it were pulled up on the internet as Morningstar Canoe, it would come up.
Huh. Yeah.
And,
gosh, I grew up in Wonder Lake on the Nipissing. It was canoes all the time. Tons of canoes, Oren.
Yeah, obviously, I'm just not finding a Morningstar Canoe for some reason.
Well, there you go.
One word, right? Or two words? How...
You should do what you know what you should do with it, Oren? Oh, he left. You know what we should do? We should just turn it over and put it next to the garage. Classic place to just store a canoe.
Yep.
Like, I feel like that was my whole life. Like, growing up, there were different places where the canoe would get grown over, you know?
Right.
the moss and the tree would eat it up, and you'd be like, you can't. You try to tip that thing back over, and it's just slugs and bugs and things like that. So,
yep.
There's two uses for a canoe, to actually canoe on the water or have it be next to the garage.
Yeah. And nowadays, people probably just make a big planner out of it or something.
Right,
you know?
Exactly. 312-981-7200. We got Rich on the line. I got some texts as well. We'll get to you guys just after this quick break. It's a swap meet. Stay with us. All right. Swap meet 312-981-7200. Greg Flam in studio at DuPage Picker, both on Facebook and Twitter. Let's go to Rich. Rich, what do you want to brag about, Rich?
Hey, I know you guys said the Life magazines are basically worth nothing unless it's a exclusive ad, but I found one that's my exact birthday, July 9, 1956, which is neat to look at to see what was going on the day you were born.
Right. We've talked in the past. I'm sorry to interrupt, but like people want the Playboy magazines from the month and year they were born, and that's kind of the novelty of it. But you could still get them for $10, $12, you know, so.
Right. Yeah, I mean, the one ad that sticks out in the back of my mind, because it's on the back, is what was Sergeant Bilko from the 50s.
Okay.
Is advertising Chesterfield cigarettes.
Right, right.
You know, and then so after I found that, I just found that in a garbage, you know, in a friend's garbage on mine. Then after that, you know, like going to flea markets, you're at that one up at
Rosemont,
yeah. Last weekend is this Sunday.
Is this Sunday's the last one?
This Sunday's the last one, and then I'll head up to Palatine for the winter. So I'll be there Saturday and Sundays. And
I've been up there a couple times in Kane County. I found one for my wife's birthday, too, and got that for a birthday present. So, I mean, that's the kind of the neat thing about the
No, they make great gifts.
And pretty inexpensive, but people think you spend a lot.
Sure.
I've still got one Playboy magazine, and I can't remember the year it is that I've been looking for at every flea market, but I know who the centerfold was. She was the one that was on the locker when I was in the Army.
Okay.
Oh, there you go. All right, Rich, thank you, buddy.
I'll find it.
Yeah.
All right.
Well, good luck.
Have a good evening. All right.
Thanks.
Bye.
There's a documentary in there somewhere trying to find the Playboy centerfold from when it was on the locker in the Army.
But, yeah, all that pinup stuff is worth a lot of money these days from back during the war. All the matchbook pinups, obviously the real centerfold pinups, all that is pretty good money.
630 says a 1933 Schlitz cone top beer can. Wow, Jim, this is Jim from Glendale Heights. 1933 Schlitz cone top beer can. What's a cone top? What does that mean?
Back early part, they would use like what looked like a STP oil can, cone type shaped top.
Oh, okay, yeah.
It would like a bottle cap on the top of it, or twist off. Mostly it was bottle cap. But yeah, those, when I was a kid collecting beer cans, that was like the big brag. If someone had a cone top beer can, you were like the king of the neighborhood. So that's what he has. I'm trying to get a price for you here.
1933 Schlitz cone top beer can.
Yeah, I'm
wonder what that would. And I'm assuming it's open. And drank at this point.
I think so. Yeah. But let's see here. Well, the good news is there's not many on there, so that's good. Let's see if I can find a sold one. No. So he's got the market cornered there. So
all right. Well, you get start the market an auction. Cornered. That's good. All right, continuing on, there's a, let's see, this is a, from 630, this looks cool. It's a silver tone radio. I don't have a year on it, but it has, it's an old time radio, small kind of, is a picture of it.
Mm-hmm.
And the best part is it's got presets, and the presets are WMAQ, WGN, WENR, WJJD, and BBM. That's pretty cool. What do you think of a silver tone desktop radio?
Because a lot of those still work because they made them to last. And I've had some old radios like that and not working that are like $100. So, but you know, could be $5, could be $300, depending if it works or not and what condition. But it's cool that it has the presets on there. What was the ENR? What did that ENR become? Do you know?
I don't know.
What number?
It doesn't have a number. Yeah. It doesn't say, yeah.
But that's interesting.
Yeah, right on. All right, let's go to Peter. Peter, what do you want to brag about, Peter?
What's up, guys?
What's up?
All right, so I have many things, but I have I acquired a tour jacket. It's an original Lee, made in USA, Bon Jovi Slippery When Wet tour from, I believe, 87-ish.
Slippery When Wet, is that the big one with Living on a Prayer and all that kind of stuff?
Yes, that was a big tour. So I got this from a pretty famous guy named Art Dexter. He's been in the auto industry, business for a long time, that painted all these hot rods and stuff.
Okay.
And I met him over the years, and he got it from one of the actual crew. It wasn't given out. I don't think they were selling them. It was worn by the band and the crew,
production, They call those production jackets. A lot of the movies do them. Can I ask, is the back logo for Bon Jovi, is that like an aqua blue on the back?
I believe it's all embroidered.
Oh, embroidered, okay.
Yeah, it's all embroidered, and, you know, it's acid wash. It looks like a million moths.
Okay. Yeah, I'm seeing a Levi's one that has embroidered Bon Jovi on it in red, if that makes any sense. And they're asking $50 best offer for that.
And you know what? I've looked on events online, but I have not seen anything close to what.
Yeah, you won't. If it's production, it's really rare. So, again, if you are going to sell it, do an auction because you have a one-of-a-kind type item. Rare now.
Right. Again, I'm not going to sell it. I'll just wear it in my grave. I just called because you guys were talking about.
I love the rock stuff.
Peter, you're going to be sitting in the casket, and they're going to be like, "This was his favorite jacket."
Yeah, it was right.
Hey, you know, funny. I was actually did a little thing on for my restaurant. I was at your studio. I don't know, a little over a year and a half ago. Okay. I was doing a live cooking for. I think it was what's his name, Calamari.
Sunday.
So I visited that studio to get.
Nice, cool. All right, thanks, Peter.
Thanks for calling.
There you go. Thanks, man. Bye-bye. It's his favorite jacket. He wanted to be buried in it.
Yep.
All right. All right. 847, I have a great Budweiser Eagle Claw flat top beer can. I don't know if that's where. Let's keep moving. 406. Wow. Back in the late 60s, I had glued together monster models with glow-in-the-dark parts. The whole set, everything from Frankenstein to Dracula to the creature to the Black Lagoon.
Yeah, those are great.
What is that?
I can't remember the name. I don't think it was Aurora. Maybe it was Aurora brand models that made that Frankenstein, Dracula, all that. And they're worth quite a bit of money now. I think about 50 to 100 each model. If I recall right. But yeah, I had one of those as a kid. I wish I still had it.
Wow.
Yep.
I like that. That's what I'm talking about. That's good. All right. Let's finish up tonight with Scott. Scott, what do you want to brag about, Scott?
Hey, I have a record album I bought at a flea market.
Okay.
And it's a Midnight Oil Blue Sky Mine album. And it was still in the wrapper.
Okay.
Classic.
And when I got home, I opened it up. And side A is Midnight Oil Blue Sky Mine, but side B is misprinted, and it's a group called Suicidal Tendency.
Oh, wow, yeah, a hardcore metal band, yeah. I was a huge Midnight Oil fan, so I love this.
How can we sleep?
Too.
I'm
right. Saw that Poplar Creek. You know, that was an awesome Poplar show.
I was there.
Yeah, that's awesome. So that's cool that it's a misprint, and you wouldn't know if you didn't open it, so it is open. But yeah, I'm going to try to get your price on that.
Yeah, that's weird. Cool. So this B-side was Suicidal Tendencies on accident?
Did you listen to it by chance? Because sometimes they just put the wrong label, but it's actual Midnight Oil pressed.
The label is Midnight Oil, but the music is.
Oh, the music is. They record. Wow. So that makes it even more money because they put the wrong music on that side. Sometimes it's just the label, which isn't as much depending on the band. Yeah, that's something to check out, and if you want to write me through the Facebook page, I'll be happy to research that for you.
Yeah, at DuPage Picker.
Mm-hmm. Facebook.
That's cool. Oh, cool. Wow, what a
Thank
weird thing.
So
thanks, Scott.
Thank
that's
you.
A good way to wrap it up tonight. Misprints accidents can get you a ton of money. And a Midnight Oil reference. I'll take that.
Yeah, I'll take
Poplar
too.
Creek, too. Both of you guys. You guys must have been party animals, you and Scott up at the Poplar Creek hanging out.
And the lead singer, he was like a politician in Australia, but he was all over climbing up. I mean, it was just an awesome show.
What's with that? What's with the? I feel like I turn into Larry David, but I'm like, why are these guys climbing over there?
I was just gonna say
Pearl Jam. What is with that?
And what I was gonna say with the Guns N' Roses, like in '89, there was kind of that fork in the road. You either went alternative or you were metal, and I kind of went the alternative. That's why this Guns N' Roses poster, I have no problem partying with it.
I should have stayed. Metal,
yeah.
Let's just say to the roots. You know, next wave of bands like what was the band that did More Than Words? Like I should have stayed with those guys.
Extreme, right? Get on it, Pete. Beats by Zim.
Greg Flam at DuPage Picker, both on Facebook and Twitter. He joins us every Wednesday. We got a week off next week.
Yep,
Hawks game. We'll return the week after. Greg, always a great to see you, buddy.
Always fun. Thanks.